Lawyer and writer Philippe Sands, and I'll be retracing the frantic 5 days of a long legal battle to bring Augusto Pinochet to justice.
We need to do something.
The Arrest on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds continues on weekdays at 1:45.
On FM, on digital and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of December. This is Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
Headlines this morning. The Kremlin says there's been no deal after talks in Moscow with American envoys to end the war in Ukraine. But the US says progress has been made. And ministers have hailed new figures suggesting that more patients in England are contacting their GPs online than by phone. We'll be talking to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting.
And also in today's programme,
I am accustomed to Sarah no longer being with us, but I rage against it.
The words of Sarah Everard's mother, voiced by the actor Tamsin Gregg, responding to another damning report on violence against women and girls. We'll ask what will lead to meaningful change. Also hear about how a play by the late Sir Tom Stoppard, led to a breakthrough in cancer treatment. It's quite a story, I promise you that. And what can be done to save England cricketers' Ashes performance?
What I recommend for the England team is that they plug in their earbuds and play an inspiring song.
Or up from the ashes, grow the roses of success.
Some advice from Sir Stephen Fry there. But first, let's get the BBC News read by Chris Aldridge.
Talks in Moscow between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's envoys have ended without a breakthrough in efforts to end the war in Ukraine. Russian officials said the discussions had not brought peace any closer, although it was also no further away. However, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio says some progress has been made. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has this report.
According to President Putin's foreign policy aide Yuri Ushakov, the discussions in the Kremlin were very useful, constructive and detailed. But after 5 hours of talks involving Vladimir Putin, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the Kremlin leader did not agree to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Referring to draft peace plans presented by America, Mr. Ushakov said Russia agreed with some points, but some things we criticised. "We have not come up with a compromise version yet," he conceded. No compromise is no real surprise, given President Putin's uncompromising statements in recent days. He's shown no desire to make concessions, convinced that Russia has the initiative on the battlefield.
The European Union says it has agreed to ban imports of Russian gas by the autumn of 2027. Russia accounts for about 12% of gas imported by member states, down from 45% before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The government has welcomed figures from the Office for National Statistics which suggest that a higher proportion of patients are now contacting their GP surgery online than on the phone. For the past 2 months, all GP surgeries in England have been required to offer a Monday to Friday online booking system, a move resisted by the Doctors' Union, the BMA. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes has more.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says figures showing 8 million patients recently got in touch with their GP online show a big step towards his promise to end the 8 a.m. scramble for an appointment. Recent data suggests a slightly higher percentage of people contacted their surgery online rather than via the phone. Almost all GP practices in England now offer online consultation requests since being required to do so. The BMA is in a formal dispute with the government over the issue, warning surgeries could be overwhelmed. NHS England says the system makes it easier for patients.
BBC analysis has found that the government has spent £100 million so far responding to the COVID inquiry. That's on top of the nearly £200 million the inquiry itself has cost, meaning the total bill is about 50% higher than previously thought. The pressure group, the Taxpayers Alliance, has called the spending a disgrace. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
The government has nearly 250 staff working across different departments to provide responses to the COVID inquiry, alongside legal teams. BBC analysis of Cabinet Office documents suggests that in just over 2 years, the government has spent £101 million doing this. Sources at the inquiry have questioned the government's approach, saying at times it has been hostile and difficult. The Taxpayers' Alliance called the spending a disgrace, but the Cabinet Office said it was committed to the inquiry and helping learn the lessons from the pandemic.
A parliamentary inquiry into the collapse of the trial of two men accused of spying for China has found no deliberate efforts in government to obstruct the prosecution. Instead, MPs and Lords on the National Security Strategy Committee blame systemic failures. Their report concludes it was surprising that the Crown Prosecution Service did not proceed with the case. Our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford has the details.
Christopher Cash and Christopher Berry were due to go on trial in October, accused of spying for China. But a few weeks before, prosecutors decided to drop the case. This led to some newspapers and MPs accusing the government of deliberately collapsing the trial to protect the UK's relationship with China. The National Security Strategy Committee has now concluded there wasn't a coordinated high-level effort to end the prosecution. But the peers and MPs found that the communications between the prosecution and the government were a shambolic process beset by confusion.
A BBC investigation has found that more than 2,000 extremely abusive social media posts, including death and rape threats, were sent about managers and players in the Premier League and Women's Super League in a single weekend last month. 4/5 of the abuse was on X. The company has acted in some form on 37 messages flagged to it. The Chelsea Super League manager, Sonia Bonpastor, was among those targeted in the abusive posts.
I think the social media companies are not doing their job, not taking again the responsibility and the accountability for that. And I think as a club, we need to support our players in the best way possible. I think if we have to wait for the social media companies to act, I think we can be in this situation for too long.
Southeast Water has apologised again to customers in Kent who've had no supply since Saturday. Last night, the company said a recurring water quality issue in the Tunbridge Wells area had slowed down its ability to return supplies to everyone as quickly as it had hoped. The first German state visit to the UK in 27 years begins today at Windsor Castle. The King and Queen will host the German president and his wife for a three-day visit that includes pageantry, diplomacy and football. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
After a state visit from President Trump in September that took place away from the public, behind the walls of Windsor Castle, the arrival of President Frank-Walter Steinmeier will have a very different feel. He and his wife will take a carriage ride through Windsor ahead of a full ceremonial welcome at the castle. This evening, both the President and the King will give speeches at the state banquet. As well as addressing Parliament, the President will meet German Premiership footballers during his trip and travel to Coventry, where he'll lay a wreath in the ruins of the city's cathedral, bombed during the Second World War.
Daniela Ralph reporting.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past six. Let us have our first go at the weather. It comes from Simon King at the BBC Weather Centre this morning. Hello, Simon.
Hello, Justin. Good morning. We've got variable conditions really over the next few days. It's going to stay quite unsettled. There'll be cloudy skies, some rain at times. And this morning, it's fog, which might have to be just careful if you're travelling and setting off first thing this morning. For southwest England and southeast England, that fog is mostly towards more northern areas around the M4 corridor. So watch out for that. But that fog will tend to lift up and clear away. And then actually, for most parts, there will be some sunny spells, but a few scattered showers, mostly across southeastern areas of England this morning. Those will become more confined towards Kent, east and west Sussex, towards Hampshire into this afternoon, and temperatures getting to about 8 to 12 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, it's here where we've got most of the fog, and that's quite dense actually in places. So yeah, really quite difficult driving conditions for some. The fog gradually lifts up through this morning. There will be lots of sunny spells and staying dry for most, but some showers likely, I think, in West Wales, temperatures of 8 to 11 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, isolated fog patches, so not too much of a problem here, and those mostly in northeastern England. It's going to be rather cloudy for most, and there'll be some showers in northwest England. However, to the east of the Pennines, we could see a few brighter skies, temperatures of 6 to 8 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland today, some showers to start off this morning. Those should mostly clear away, looking dry this afternoon. A few bright spells, temperatures of 6 or 7 degrees. And across Scotland, variable cloud, a few showers in western and northern areas, but there'd also be some sunny spells developing for a time, and temperatures of 5 to 8 Celsius.
Simon, thanks very much. It is 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers and the headlines across those papers and the news website. Photos of all 97 victims of the Hillsborough disaster feature on the front page of the I newspaper after the publication of what the Times calls a damning report on the police's actions during the stadium crush. The Daily Mirror says it confirms what families have feared all along. Nobody will face justice. The paper claims that officers criticised for their failures have been allowed to simply walk away. One woman whose son was killed in the tragedy is quoted in The Guardian as saying how lucky they are to grow old.
A Reform UK donor tells the Financial Times that Nigel Farage has said he expects the party to either make a deal or merge with the Conservatives before the next election. The unnamed donor says the move would be aimed at easing Reform's route to victory. But Mr Farage himself tells the paper he would never do a deal with a party he doesn't trust, adding that a deal with the Tories as they are would cost his party votes.
According to the Daily Telegraph, the top civil servant at the Treasury has been dragged into the row over whether the Chancellor misled the public about the state of the UK's finances. It reports that James Bowler approved the publication of a letter that showed Rachel Reeves knew the financial hole was smaller than previously thought. An MP on the Treasury Select Committee tells the paper he was probably uncomfortable with the way the political team were leaking stuff. But Treasury insiders deny any split and insist Ms Reeves approved the letter's release.
Daily Mail says that following what it calls Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's rent scandal, Pandora's box has been opened with a new investigation into homes owned by the Crown Estate. The paper says the probe is going to scrutinise the deal on the Prince and Princess of Wales's new family home in Windsor Great Park.
And The Sun says that England fans are being clobbered with the most expensive World Cup tickets ever seen. The paper says FIFA has grabbed a share of the resale market, taking a 15% cut from both buyer and seller. According to the report, tickets are already going for £1,000, with some listed for nearly £33,000.
11 minutes past six is the time. 5 hours of talks between Russia and the US have failed to produce a breakthrough, though the Kremlin says they were constructive. What is the view in Kiev? Let's talk to James Waterhouse, our correspondent there. Tell us what is being saying, if anything, this morning, James.
Morning, Justin. We haven't had much by the way of reaction by Volodymyr Zelensky. He was in Ireland yesterday where, in a post, his last post merely said that this war needs to be stopped so Russia doesn't invade for a third time in a year's time. And I think that is the confidence that Ukraine wants to have in a final peace deal that could end this war. He notably didn't do a daily address late last night either. Ukraine is waiting and watching to see what, if anything, will come out of Moscow. There were reports that Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner would perhaps meet with him in a European country to debrief, to discuss what the Russian response had been. It seems that is not happening. And I think the warning signs were there going into these talks when you saw Vladimir Putin again give these uncompromising statements, criticising Europe, saying, look, we have no plans to invade Europe. But if it wants war, it's got it. I mean, that is not, I think, off the back of him appearing in military fatigues the day before that. It is not appearing like Russia is keen in any way to pause this war. As for the document itself, I mean, Yuri Ushakov, one of the senior Russian negotiators, said a 28-point plan had become a 27-point one, but we weren't just presented with that. The Americans, he said, presented us with four documents, and you know, there is no revised edition yet. And I think from a Ukrainian perspective, this is par for the Russian course. They expect Moscow to take their time to consider their response before that response reveals a continued maximalist condition for Ukraine's capitulation, not least with the misty battlefield revealing continued Russian gains.
Yeah. Ah, well, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because my question to you was going to be, what is actually happening? Because we lose sight sometimes when we're talking about all these things, don't we? We lose sight of the human suffering, but also of the moves that there are or are not on the battlefield. So bring us up to date with that.
We absolutely do. I mean, I'm just looking at the latest update from Oleksandr Syrsky, the head of the Ukrainian armed forces, and he's talking about, you hear these terms when things aren't going well, terms like stabilization, situation intense, moving to stronger positions. I mean, I'm not saying that's completely happening this time, but there is a city called Kupiansk that we were last at 2 years ago when the Russians were 8 kilometres away. Now the Russians are inside the city and the Ukrainians are trying to stem their attack. Now that invading troops have crossed the river, that city is gradually being emptied of life. The same could be said for Pokrovsk. Listeners would have heard about this place over and over now. It's when a city dominates the headlines that you know that there is an intense pressure. Pokrovsk was a vibrant military hub. At one stage, the Russians were 40 kilometres away. Now they are, according to some reports, 95% in control of the city, the food stalls, the restaurants, the hotels. They are all gone now. And you now have Russian troops once again raising the flag under the name of so-called liberation. And this is a trend, you fear, given that we are now in winter conditions, that is not going to stop. It's meant to be difficult for the Russians to make advances when the conditions are the way they are. And yet they are getting these, you know, they might not be militarily significant, but they are key trophies at a time of intense negotiations.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv, thank you.
It is 6:15. A BBC investigation has found that more than 2,000 extremely abusive social media posts, including death and rape threats, were sent about managers and players in the Premier League and the Women's Super League in a single weekend. Man United boss Ruben Amorim and Liverpool's Arne Slot and Newcastle's Eddie Howe were the most common targets of abuse in the men's game, whilst Chelsea manager Sonia Bonpastor faced 50% of all abuse in the women's game. Sonia has told us about social media companies simply not doing enough.
I think the social media companies are not doing their job, not taking again the responsibility and the accountability for that. And I think as a club, we need to support our players in the best way possible. I think if we have to wait for the social media companies to act, I think we can be in this situation for too long.
Natalie Perks is BBC Sports correspondent, our BBC Sports correspondent, joining us now. How many and how serious were these posts? Can you give us a sense of that?
Absolutely. As you can imagine, there's quite a lot of data, but essentially we asked the data science company Signify to monitor all public posts on Instagram, X, Facebook and TikTok across 10 Premier League matches and 6 Women's Super League matches in one weekend in November. And they use an AI system called Threat Matrix to filter out what it thinks could be abusive. And then the Signify's human team checks all of those messages twice. So they looked at more than 500,000 messages. Their AI system flagged 22,000 of them. And then humans found 2,015 messages containing abuse so bad they broke the social media platform's own guidelines. And then further to that, 39 were considered so egregious they required further investigation, including one which was flagged to the police. And I thought what was quite interesting was it's often claimed that the majority of the abuse comes from abroad. But on that particular weekend, 61% of the verified abuse came from the UK and Ireland.
And in terms of, I know that the BBC's contacted X and Meta with questions about this. What's been said?
Well, they've actually taken action. And it's nuanced and it's a little bit tricky. So X is really the platform of live sport. It's where people go to talk about it. And it's no surprise that 82% of the verified abuse we found was on X. And when we spoke to them, or when Signify spoke to them, they flagged 37 messages. They've actioned in some form all of them. That doesn't mean they've taken them all down. Some of them, they like to do something called shadow banning, which is restricting access to them. So you'd really have to go looking. And Meta, which is the parent company, of course, of Instagram and Facebook, 15.1% of the abuse we found was on there. One comment actually containing the most horrendous racial slurs was immediately removed. And we're told they're actively investigating 5 other messages that Signify put to them.
I mean, I suppose just finally, very quickly, you know, there are those who will be saying it's not to do with the technology platforms, although it's important to get those things down, of course. This is a societal ill. This is a reflection of sports fans.
Absolutely. There's been a 25% year-on-year rise in online abuse, according to Signify. That's what they're seeing. It's not going to change. It's going to get worse. And that's why clubs, for example, like Chelsea, in the last 15 minutes, they've confirmed they've taken on Signify as a client to get on the front foot. And as Sonia Bonpastor said, they want to see fans being banned from stadiums. And that has worked for Arsenal. They've actually been doing this for 3 years, actively banning fans. And they've seen a 90% drop in their own fans abusing people online because real life problems require real life consequences.
Natalie Perks, BBC Sports correspondent. Thank you.
19 minutes past six. One of the world's biggest advertising companies, well, that's what it used to be, the British business WPP, now looks set to be considerably smaller. So small, indeed, it's dropping out of the FTSE 100. Sean is here with that and the rest of the morning's business news. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Justin. Yes, so the FTSE 100, of course, made up of those 100 most valuable companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. And for the first time since 1998, it looks like WPP won't be worth enough to stay in that group. It was the advertising giant built by Sir Martin Sorrell, seen its share price tumble of late, falling by two-thirds in the last year. Brian Weezer is principal at the consultancy Madison and Wall, and he was previously global president at Group M, which was WPP's investment arm. Brian, good morning to you. Why the fall in market value?
Well, you know, first of all, thanks for having me on. The market value fall is a reflection of the real struggles that the business is having. And I would argue that the choices not made in 2018, 2019, 2020, we're really seeing the consequences of a failure to adapt to the world that was going to play out, which Publicis, their primary competitor based in France, anticipated better than others. And now they're at least making the moves to transition by blowing parts of the company up, which needs to happen.
So is this about how the company was run, the company that that ended up being built by Martin Sorrell? Or is it about threats like AI coming in and just eating bigger parts of their pie?
The AI threat is part of it, but if that were the primary problem, Publicis would be struggling much more from a market capitalization perspective. The problem is that no one, whether you're public or private, wants to try to catch a falling knife. The numbers are bad and have gotten worse. Again, the current state, the organic growth or the organic declines are a function of the failure to make certain choices in years past. Investors are reacting to what they're seeing in front of them. They're reacting to numbers that only get worse. And frankly, the fact that the numbers got worse after the downgrade timed to Mark Read, the prior CEO's departure, that didn't make it look good either. Right. But it's basically the same story.
Brian, thank you. Good to talk to you this morning. Brian Weezer there from the consultancy Madison and Wall, formerly at WPP. WPP, when we put this to them, said they were taking further steps to capitalize on their market-leading investments in AI and get the company back to growth. The boss of one of the country's biggest wealth managers has told us the UK mustn't be defeatist following the budget. This is Mark Fitzpatrick, who's chief executive of St James's Place, the wealth management company, which looks after nearly £200 billion worth of investments. SJB changed the way it charged its customers in August following years of complaints over fees, which used to include an exit penalty as well if someone left within their first 6 years. And Mark Fitzpatrick's been in charge for a couple of years now. In that time, the company's left, re-entered the FTSE 100 itself. In the last 12 months, its share price has been up by more than 50%. And I sat down with him for the latest episode of the Big Boss Interview podcast, which you can catch on BBC Sounds right now. He also told me speculation in the run-up to the budget had damaged people's pensions. We've got more on that in an hour's time. After the budget as well, there have been concerns about ambitions for growth. I also spoke to Mark Fitzpatrick about that and if he was concerned.
I think the government came in talking a lot about growth, and it is really important that government and indeed the business community stay focused on the growth potential that is in the UK. It is very easy to get into a negative spiral. I think the UK is a great place. I've been in the UK 25 years now. It's been very kind to me and my family. My three kids are all English. It is really, really important that we try and find ways to support the UK, to grow the UK, to invest back into the UK. It's very easy to nitpick and get negative about it. And the negativity doesn't actually help us at all. So not looking to be naive, but there are some great companies. There's some great things we do in the UK. If you think of the pharmaceutical industry, if you think of some of the biotech, the FT industry, defense industry, creative industry, like in this great building, there are great, great talented people in this country, and we should support, encourage, develop them rather than allow a cloud of negativity just to swamp over us and absolutely drown the sentiment.
But is the cloud of negativity the asking a question, was there growth, or is the cloud the budget itself?
We need to find the growth. The government has come out with a new budget, we can either react negatively to it or we can look to see, right, how do we adjust for it and how do we continue to grow? In our sector, there is such a lot of demand. There are less than 8% of people, adults in the UK, who take advice. There are millions more who say they want advice but don't know how to access it. So we need to make it easier for them to access advice to be able to provide support. There are a lot of growth opportunities in the UK. The government's made its pronouncements. We now need to adjust to be able to focus on the growth algorithm rather than say it's all too difficult because of what the government's done. We can't be defeatist.
So we have to reflect on the job you have had to do since you became chief executive of St James's Place, because is it fair to say that you had a cultural change of a job on your hands, given in the years before you arrived the reputation St James's Place had for high fees and also the way the company was spending some of that money it was earning from its customers?
There has been a large change agenda at St James's Place. It has been a busy couple of years. I've been there just 2 years now. We have, I think, achieved a lot. Our people, our advisors have done a fantastic job. When we went through our difficult days 2 years ago, what it showed us was the strength of relationship between the advisor and the client. That got us through the dark days. We have
just
now,
explain what happened a couple of years ago, what you were dealing with.
So we had a situation where the regulatory environment changed and the fee structure that we had was no longer tenable in the new world. So we needed to change the fee structure. We had a situation where the media was very focused on how we were engaging with our advisors. And there was a real sense that SJP, despite being the biggest in the market, was very expensive and complex to do business with. So over the last few years, we have massively simplified our fee structure. It is now comparable, very, very transparent. We have grown the business significantly. We've spent a lot of money investing in our brand. I brought a lot of new people into the organization, along with people who've been with us a long time, who really have longevity of relationships with the advisors, to bring the best of both together to be able to prepare the business for growth.
The company you arrived at,
yeah.
Did you see a company that wasn't serving its customers well?
I saw a business that was serving its customers well, because otherwise we wouldn't have had 95% client retention. So there was a lot of noise. A lot of that noise was coming from our competitors and some of the media who got themselves into a bit of a frenzy around our fee levels.
But a frenzy, it feels like a harsh word when at a later point you've got a £500 million pot that you're preparing to pay out for complaints.
The unbundling of the fees gave people and has given people absolute clarity on the different component parts. And the feedback we've had from clients is it's now clearer and it's easier for me to understand. It's easier for me to compare in the marketplace. The fees haven't really changed in absolute levels from before and after. So there wasn't an element of we were charging clients a whole lot more than others along the way. And I think people now see that and people now recognize it. And the market now recognizes that.
Mark Fitzpatrick, Chief Executive of St James's Place.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Plenty more of that conversation on BBC Sounds Big Boss Interview. Rachel Winter is partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. Morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Sean.
Another topic we got into in that wider interview was their views and Mark Fitzpatrick's views on AI, whether it's a bubble or not. He talked about St James's Place being underweight, not having as much investment as I'd say the market on average might have in AI. I see headlines in the FT this morning. British pension funds dump US stocks on AI bubble fears. We got warnings from the Bank of England yesterday about a $5 trillion AI bubble. Is this starting to play out more now?
There has been some profit taking after a very good run for a lot of these stocks. But I'll just mention those Bank of England comments that you just mentioned there. So the Bank of England has suggested that valuations are quite high for AI stocks. I would make the point that back in the dot-com bubble, the price-to-earnings ratio, which is how we measure how expensive a stock is, was about 100 for the Nasdaq Composite Index. That ratio is now around 33. So stocks are nowhere near as expensive now as they were back then.
And making a few headlines this morning Rachel, from the report yesterday from the Organisation of Economic Cooperation and Development, which has expressed concerns about the tax and decisions made in the budget and what that will do for growth. The fact it says inflation in the UK will remain amongst the highest, growth in the UK still be ranking in the top three in 2026 when it comes to the G7. Is there? How would you take this report from the OECD?
I think it's a small positive. So they have predicted that the UK will grow 1.2% next year, which is obviously not a high rate of growth. But as you said, it is one of the best in the G7. Reading the small print from this report, a lot of the blame is actually put on last year's budget, which added a lot of extra cost onto employers. And that has made it more difficult to grow the economy.
Rachel, good to talk to you this morning. Rachel Winter from Killick & Co. I'll be back after seven with a bit more from that boss of St James's Place, talking about all that speculation in the run-up to, well, not just this year's budget, last year as well, and the damage that it did to people's pensions. His words, we'll hear more of that then.
Sean, thanks very much for that. We look forward to it. Now, let's get the latest on the sport. Mike's just joined us. It's 29, or just gone, sorry, 6:30.
Emma, thank you. Good morning. We've just had the business news, and fans at Craven Cottage last night certainly got value for money.
And there's the whistle. It's a Premier League classic, but it's one ultimately won by Manchester City. But goodness me, did Fulham give them a fright. From 5-1 down to 5-4.
Yes, 9 goals in an incredibly entertaining match in West London. Fulham were 5-1 down to Manchester City, got it back to 5-4. They then had one cleared off the line, which would have made it 5-5. In the end, Manchester City held on for the win. Erling Haaland got the first goal for City, but even he lost track of the score at times.
I think at 5-2, I was, no, 5-2 or 5-3, I was close scoring 6-3. Yeah. And then a minute after, they go and score. So that's football. That's the beauty of football. And that's why we love the game.
Haaland became the quickest player to reach 100 Premier League goals in that match last night, doing so in 111 games. So what about Marco Silva's Fulham? A valiant effort from them, but nothing to show for it.
The reaction from the fans throughout all the second half and in the end, the connection with the players. We didn't take nothing from this game in terms of points, but we take many positives as well. And that reaction in the end, the respect that the fans they showed for our players was very, very important for them and is going to boost us for Sunday.
Elsewhere, a 95th minute overhead kick from captain Christian Romero saw Tottenham draw 2-2 at Newcastle. Everton beat Bournemouth by 1-0. Next to cricket, and this time tomorrow, the second Ashes test will be underway. The day-nighter in Brisbane gets underway at 4 a.m. Thursday morning. Despite regular captain Pat Cummings not being named in the Australia squad for the game after a back injury, there is still a possibility the fast bowler could yet play, according to stand-in skipper Steve Smith.
He looks pretty good to me, the way he's bowled in the nets. Yeah, obviously games a different intensity for sure, but he's tracking really nicely, he knows his body well, and we'll wait and see. A whole heap of things I think are on the table.
And we're expecting to hear from England captain Ben Stokes in the next hour or so. We'll bring you his thoughts later in the programme. Finally, a curious story from the world of tennis. Serena Williams has filed paperwork for a return to the sport, but then denied that she's making a comeback. The 44-year-old has re-entered the sport's drug testing pool, but quickly took to social media to say no return was planned. Here's Russell Fuller.
"This wildfire is crazy," Williams posted, without explaining why she would want to invite a visit from drug testers if she has no intention of returning to the sport she left 3 years ago. The International Tennis Integrity Agency has confirmed that 23-time Grand Slam singles champion is back on its list of registered players, as any retired player would have to be for 6 months before being eligible to play professionally again. Serena's older sister Venus returned after a 16-month absence this year, with the 45-year-old playing singles and doubles at the US Open.
Don't call it a comeback, but we shall see.
We shall see. It's rather exciting. Thanks very much, Mike.
There he is.
My name's Pine. I'm the night manager.
On BBC iPlayer.
Richard Roper is selling arms in the heart of Cairo. I want to put you inside his operation.
You got any idea how dangerous that is?
The brand new series of The Night Manager is coming.
You have to commit.
Get ready by watching series one.
Anyone can betray anyone.
You have to make a decision.
Don't you dare threaten me!
The Night Manager.
Oh, I can't wait.
On BBC iPlayer.
Time now is 27 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and with Justin Webb and with Chris Aldridge with the news.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio says some progress has been made in talks with Russia to end its war with Ukraine. The meeting in Moscow between President Putin and US envoys ended after 5 hours last night. A Kremlin spokesman said the meeting was constructive, but parts of the plan remained unacceptable to Russia. New figures from the Office for National Statistics suggest that a higher proportion of patients are now contacting their GP surgery online than on the phone. For the past 2 months, all GP surgeries in England have been required to offer an online booking system, a move resisted by the doctors' union, the BMA. The government has welcomed the increase in patients booking online. The public inquiry into the COVID pandemic has cost the government more than £100 million to respond to so far. That's on top of the nearly £200 million the inquiry itself has cost, meaning the cost to the taxpayer is about 50% higher than previously thought. The pressure group, the Taxpayers' Alliance, has called the spending a disgrace. A parliamentary inquiry into the collapse of the trial of two men accused of spying for China has criticised the government for systemic failures. MPs and Lords on the National Security Strategy Committee found no deliberate efforts in government to obstruct the prosecution. Instead, the committee blamed a shambolic process and concluded it was surprising that the Crown Prosecution Service did not proceed with the case. For the first time in 27 years, the German president is making a state visit to the UK. Frank-Walter Steinmeier will be hosted by the King and Queen at Windsor Castle. Over the next 3 days, he'll address Parliament, attend the V&A Museum in London, and lay a wreath in the ruins of Coventry Cathedral, which was bombed during the Second World War.
Chris, thank you. 25 to 7 is the time. The government is claiming a big win in the way that people can book doctor's appointments, though the doctor's union, the BMA, opposes it. We were hearing the details of it just there in the news summary. Basically, people are using online methods of booking more than they were. Dominic Hughes is our health correspondent. The intention was that this gets rid of that sort of 8 a.m. scramble, isn't it, Dominic? Is that what the government is claiming has happened?
Yeah, they say it's a big step on the way to doing that. That was a key government promise, really, was to sort out the 8 a.m. scramble for a GP appointment, which will be familiar to many listeners, I'm sure. Now, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says that figures showing that 8 million patients used online access in October demonstrates that big step towards achieving that promise. And actually, that's backed up by ONS data that covers 3 weeks from mid-September. And that suggests that just over 43% of people went online to contact their GP, compared with just 41% who contacted their GP via the phone. And that's the first time, I think, that the numbers using online versus the phone, they outnumber them. So they say that the Department of Health says that almost every GP practice in England now has rolled out online consultation requests after they were required to do so from the beginning of October.
The GPs, though, themselves, and we're going to hear from one after 7 o'clock, are not happy about it.
No, the whole thing was resisted by the BMA because they said that the argument was that GP practices risked being overwhelmed by demand and that patients could be put at risk. Part of that concern was about that there was no triaging available on the online system. They are now in formal dispute with the government over that issue. So it was very patchy. I mean, my GP surgery operated online consultations for years, but it was very, very patchy. And that, I think, it was the concern from the BMA was that if it was rolled out from October, not every GP surgery would be set up properly to cope with the system.
Dominic Hughes, thank you. We'll be talking to Wes Streeting, Health Secretary for England, at 8:10.
At 22 minutes to 7, let me ask you, do you remember the trial of two men accused of spying for China that collapsed? I'm sure you do, even if you can't remember all of the details. A parliamentary inquiry into it has come back. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, what's been found?
Morning, Emma. So I guess the summary of this report would be that it was the proverbial rather than a conspiracy. This is, as a reminder, the high-profile collapse of what was set to be a very high-profile trial of Christopher Cash and Christopher Berry, both of whom faced allegations of espionage under the Official Secrets Act. They both consistently denied wrongdoing, and it was never tested in court because the charges were unexpectedly dropped in September after the Crown Prosecution Service said it hadn't been provided with sufficient evidence by the government. Now, what gave all this such political charge, the reason people were talking about it here in Westminster for ages, was the accusation from the government's political opponents that the case collapsed essentially because the government wanted it to. And this report by the Cross-Party Joint Committee on National Security Strategy finds that that was not the case. It says instead that the case collapsed because of a shambolic process in which especially the CPS, but to some extent bits of government, are implicated. It says it was a process beset by confusion and misaligned expectations and inadequate communication between the government and the CPS.
Do you think that'll put paid to the matter? We are going to talk to the person in at the head of that security council to try and get a bit more on this and some of that thinking behind those conclusions. But, you know, the accusations from newspapers, MPs, individuals who accuse the government of deliberately collapsing that trial to protect our relationship with China, do you think it will quieten them?
Well, there's definitely still outstanding questions, for example, for the CPS, about why they believe that a separate spying case in July 2024 meant that the legal bar that needed to be cleared in this case was higher. The committee says it's surprised by that. There are some questions, I think, still for the government, albeit more minor ones than the ones that were being posed a few weeks ago. Committee says the level of senior oversight into what was happening at their end of the process was insufficient. But the big question, which I think hangs over all of this and is still outstanding, is what should Britain's relationship with China be? And that, I think, there is still going to be lots of heated debate about, for sure. The Prime Minister gave a bit of a clue earlier this week at the Lady Mayor's banquet, where he talked about China as a nation of immense scale, ambition and ingenuity, which Britain must approach with strength, clarity and sober realism. We're still expecting him, probably quite early next year, to become the first Prime Minister to visit China in 8 years. So I think there's plenty of debate still to run in the broader question of the UK's relationship with China.
Henry Zevon, our chief political correspondent, thank you.
19 minutes to seven. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has told MPs he plans to scrap jury trials in England and Wales for crimes likely to attract a sentence of less than 3 years. The proposal's following those recommendations made by the retired judge, Sir Brian Leveson. But there were cries from MPs right across the Commons yesterday that the plans undermined ancient rights and freedoms. Here is our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
There are many aspects of early 13th century England no one would want to keep. The pestilence, say, the flogging, the serfdom. But there is a piece of parchment from then everyone still likes to pray and aid.
We're all proud of our justice system rooted in the Magna Carta. But we must never forget that it implores us not to deny or delay justice.
The Justice Secretary, David Lammy. He mentioned Magna Carta because he knew that his critics would use it to denounce his plans to restrict trial by jury in England and Wales. Cases likely to entail a sentence of less than 3 years will be heard by a judge alone. The intention is to cut the backlog in the courts. He argued that more money was going into the system, but that alone could not fix the problems. And at the moment, victims were waiting years for justice, while criminals knew it was in their interest to choose a jury trial.
Let's be honest, it's a peculiar way to run a public service. Our world-leading judges should hear the most serious cases, and I agree that they and the magistracy should decide where a case is heard. This will prevent defendants from gaming the system, choosing whichever court they think gives the best chance of success, and drawing out the process, hoping victims give up.
Now, Magna Carta protected the rights and liberties of barons in the church rather than ordinary people from King John. But the Conservative Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, saw modern parallels.
800 years on from the Magna Carta, we have another unpopular leader who doesn't listen to his subjects, levies eye-watering taxes, and a state that locks people up for what they say.
He said the link between citizens and the way justice was dispensed was as important as ever.
Our ancestors did not stop bad King John, only to be undone 800 years later by this Prime Minister and his court jester.
David Lammy didn't deny that he'd spoken up for jury trials in the past, but insisted this was the only way to protect them after 14 years of Tory-led austerity and cuts.
We have to reform the system, or we will break it.
Speaking for the Lib Dems, Jess Brown-Fuller thought there was a better way to stop the backlogs. A lot of court time was currently wasted because nothing worked properly.
Maybe the witness care unit forgets to tell witnesses to attend, or key evidence isn't served until the day of trial so the defence has no time to consider it, or there's not enough court staff to manage the security on the door and the trial runs late, or our crumbling court infrastructure results in no running water, a broken lift, even flooded courtrooms.
Diane Abbott, the longest-serving woman MP, who's currently an independent after being suspended from the Parliamentary Labour Party for a second time, said everyone wanted to see justice for victims.
But the entire House is also concerned about the men and women who will undoubtedly suffer miscarriages of justice if the right to trial by jury is curtailed.
Quite a few Labour MPs had misgivings. Clive Efford felt judges tended to be drawn from a certain class of people.
The check and balance on that is that the jury can be drawn from amongst the, what we might include, working class people, as I would describe them. Does he fear that we're going to create an us and them in the criminal justice system by taking away people's right to go to trial by jury?
David Lammy said only 3% of cases went to jury trials now. Most cases were tried by magistrates who were often volunteers living in the neighbourhood. But a Conservative, Saki Batty, was still worried Magna Carta was being ripped up.
800 years of legal frameworks are being upended, not to save backlogs, it's not to save money. There's a reframing of rights and where power lies, taking power away from the people. Does the Lord Chancellor agree? Does he accept that jury trials, having your peers judge you, it protects the vulnerable and enables fairness?
David Lammy thought the current system went back about 50 years, not 800 anyway.
Our criminal law cannot just be set in aspic. The system that we have now largely came about as a result of legislation in 1971. Just prior to that, this House outlawed homosexuality. It was only in 1991 that we outlawed marital rape. So of course we make change, and it's right that we make change in this circumstance.
The Justice Secretary will hope those arguments can placate any would-be rebel barons on the Labour benches at least.
Susan Hume reporting. Well, speaking of the Justice Secretary, 12 prisoners have been accidentally released in the past 3 weeks, two of whom are still at large. That was confirmed by David Lammy on this programme yesterday. It comes on top of the 91 prisoners freed by mistake between April and October in England and Wales. But he also claimed that there was a downward trend due to the checks he introduced after the mistaken release of Hedesh Kabatu, a migrant sex offender, in September. Here's what he had to say to Anna Foster on the programme yesterday.
I'm talking about the checks that I've put in place since the Kabatu release recently. And it looks to me, from what I'm seeing, that there is a downward trend. But I've
but
also,
you can't say that 100%.
Anna, please
though.
Let me finish the point.
But you're not answering my question,
I am answering
Mr.
the question. If you let me finish the point, please do. But I've also said that there is caution around this because it's a paper-based system. We have junior officers doing this work. I'm still waiting for Dame Lynn Owens to report and to act on her recommendations. And there are still errors happening in the system. I cannot rule out human error in a paper-based system where we have 57,000 releases. There have always been releases in error over my lifetime and your lifetime. But this spike is unacceptable. It began under the last government. I am attempting to bear down on it. It will take time and investment right across our prison system.
Is he right? A downward trend? And what's going on at the moment? This is against a backdrop of England's prisons. You may have seen the story yesterday. Losing almost 150,000 working days because of mental ill health. That's up 44% since 2019. Charlie Taylor is HM Inspectorate of Prisons. Charlie, good morning.
Good morning.
Is he right? Is it a downward trend?
Well, we'll need to have a look at this over the course of time, but certainly this was always going to be something that was extremely difficult to fix quickly. It's an incredibly complex process, calculating sentences, because you have so many prisoners who've got concurrent sentences or consecutive sentences, or they're on remand for a further offence, or they're potentially an immigration case. And as the Secretary of State said, this is done still with a relatively junior member of staff and a pencil, paper and a calculator.
And so the point is, we don't know yet, is what you're saying about a downward
trend. We don't know yet.
Okay.
And bear in mind that the cases that come to light are only the ones that someone actually discovers. So it may be that there are a fair number of cases that actually people are released early and no one knows anything about it. So these cases generally are only picked up because a warrant comes through from the court or because the prisoner moves on to another jail and they discover that the sentence calculation has gone wrong. And what we're seeing, as well as early releases, we've also seen an absolute spike in late releases as well. So these are people being held beyond the end of their sentence. And again, we don't have a number for this because the Ministry of Justice doesn't collect data. But when we inspected Pentonville earlier this year, in the 6 months before our inspection, 130, 23% of prisoners had been released late. And in 2024-25, there have been just 16 early releases. So there is a big issue in the prison service at the moment with sentence calculation. It's going wrong in lots of ways.
Yes, and they're sort of two sides of the same coin, aren't they? Because you're saying it's going wrong both ways, although the public will be much more concerned about the former. People coming out early, maybe not, shouldn't be out. I mean, in fact, we're going to come to some of the related issues around women's safety a bit later on in the programme. But just in terms of why it's happening, you talked about junior staff. Is it as simple as that? That, you know, and I'm also minded of what I said around mental health vacancies and time off at the moment.
Well, indeed. And what we're seeing because of the prison population pressures, that the jails where most of these releases come from, places like Wandsworth, places like Chelmsford, which have been in the news recently, are some of the busiest jails in the country. And because of these population pressures, the churn in those prisons is even higher than ever. Now, there are three checks that ought to be done. There should be a check done within 10 days of someone coming into prison where their sentence gets calculated. There should then be a 14-day check before they're released, and there should be another check done 2 days before they come out as well. And those should be checked not only by that person, but by a manager as well. But for whatever reason, probably to do with workloads, probably to do with inexperience, probably to do with the general churn within the prisons, this just simply isn't happening in many of the cases.
Is it all done by pen and paper?
It's done by pen, paper and a calculator. It's astonishing.
I mean, in this era of, you know, where I feel every sort of second conversation I sometimes have at the moment is about artificial intelligence, are we not beyond that?
Step into a prison and you step way back in time when it comes to technology. They've only fairly recently got rid of spider phones and been able to do video calls with each other. So, yes, prisons have got a long way to go when it comes to the use of technology.
And do you think just some staff don't understand the sentencing and the structure of it and release dates?
Well, I think you need to make sure that people are properly trained to do what has become increasingly complicated with lots of different changes to sentencing practice. So we saw the early release schemes under the Conservative government at various different stages, and then we've seen early release schemes under this government. So the landscape has become more complicated over the course of time, and that means that some members of staff just haven't been able to keep up in these very, very busy prisons.
And about safety then, how concerned are you, knowing what you know and the detail you have, around the safety of all of us if this is happening and people who shouldn't be released are being released?
Well, of course it's risky. If people are getting out before they're supposed to be leaving prison, and if, God forbid, they go on to commit a serious further offence, that is, of course, an enormous concern. The public rightly expects that if people are sent to prison, they are sentenced for a period of time, and they get out when they're supposed to get out, whether that's early or whether that's late. So, look, many of these people, it's only a day or two that they're coming out early, so the risk is probably less high. But nevertheless, it's a serious failure within the prison service.
And your view on the solution is what? I mean, it's obviously clear you want some technological reform. Is it better training? Is it more staff? What is it?
Well, it is. It's better training. This is a job that's been pushed down and down and down to lower and lower level staff over the course of time. So what we want to make sure, and the Secretary of State's been very adamant about this, he wants to see a digital solution, but that will take time. And as we know, government IT doesn't always work at the pace that one might want it to. But in the meantime, making sure that people are properly trained, and also that we don't see a constant change in sentencing policy as well, because that does make things more difficult within individual prisons.
Charlie Taylor, His Majesty's Inspectorate of Prisons. Thank you.
And that brings us to 7 minutes to seven. Germany's president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, comes to Britain today. You might think that's no big deal, but we haven't had a German state visit to Britain, apparently, for 27 years. Let's talk to Jürgen Hart, who's on the line, who is the foreign policy spokesperson for the CDU-CSU parliamentary group, the CDU, the party of the current German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Are you surprised by the 27-year gap?
Yes, I was wondering about that we didn't have a state visit since 27 years. But to be frank, the German president is not a governing president. And therefore, the contacts between the governments are important. And I think we have more contacts between Friedrich Merz, the German Chancellor, and the Prime Minister of UK in the last months and years than in times before. This is a good opportunity now to strengthen the relations and to underline that we have a new era with the Kensington Treaty, with the friendship treaty between Germany and Great Britain, and that we have challenges to face Russia, Ukraine. You know?
Yeah, because it's worth saying, isn't it, although he's not a governing president, and indeed our king is not a governing king in that sense, it is still something that is ordered by the governments. The governments think it's worthwhile to do, and the impact of it could be what, do you think?
It's for me, it's a symbol and a signal to the British people, as the visit of the King, His Majesty the King, was in Germany, which was very much appreciated by the German people. I was an eyewitness of his speech in the German Bundestag, partly delivered in German language, in excellent German language. This was a huge positive signal from UK to Germany, and I hope the same will with President Steinmeier's visit today and the next 2 days. And he will be accompanied by the German foreign minister, Joe Wadephul. And I think there can be also the chance to have political talks among the foreign ministers, especially on the issues on the table.
Yeah, and obviously one of those issues, the biggest in a sense, is Ukraine, isn't it? And I just wonder whether that, the importance of Europe bringing itself together in the light of everything that is happening in Ukraine, is actually what underlines all of this.
I think we reach a huge progress in German and British and French leadership in the last weeks in that challenging situation with the negotiations between Russia and America. I think the E3, so-called E3, which is not only European Union, but the leading of European NATO, it's a good pillar to make clear that we want to support Ukraine also in the future, because we think that Ukraine is fighting our war, a war that hopefully we not have to do if Ukraine is successful with pushing back the Russian aggression. And therefore, we should give a strong commitment on further support on Ukraine. And also on our own military capabilities. And it's a pity that the negotiations between European Union and Great Britain on the question of safe participation of UK in the projects of the European Union, where smaller countries would be able to loan money to invest into defense. UK is unfortunately not with that program because the negotiations failed last week. But UK will benefit a lot from that European Union program on defense capabilities, because of course the British defense industry is very strong and probably will get a lot of contracts and orders from European NATO members due to its military capabilities.
Jürgen Hart, thank you very much.
And now a word from Martha Carney with a look ahead to tomorrow.
In the new series of This Natural Life, I have some exceptional guests who all share one passion, a love of nature. That's lifelong for His Majesty the King.
I think always putting something back into nature in return for what we take out.
I also meet comedian Kiri Pritchard-McLean on a love island in North Wales.
Straight ahead of us, that is the grave of Santa Stwynwen, and she is our patron saint of lovers.
Join me, Martha Carney, for This Natural Life, tomorrow afternoon at 3 on Radio 4, or listen to the series so far on BBC Sounds.
Weather time now comes from Simon King.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. It's a bit of a chilly start out there this morning, but it's fog that could cause a few problems if you are commuting early on, particularly around parts of Wales, the Midlands and eastern England. The fog is really quite dense in places, so that could cause some issues. The fog, though, will lift up and clear away from Wales, the Midlands and eastern England. There'll be some sunny spells into this afternoon. Dry for most as well, but a few showers expected across West Wales, and temperatures getting to about 8 to 11 degrees. In southwest England and southeast England, again, there are a few mist and fog patches, particularly around the M4 corridor. Those should lift up and clear away. It's going to be a dry day for most, but we do have a few showers across mostly southeastern areas of England. And those showers will continue in parts of Kent, east and west Sussex and Hampshire into this afternoon. Temperatures of 8 to 12 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, isolated fog patches this morning clearing away. Rather cloudy for most, with a few showers in northwest England, but towards the east of the Pennines, the cloud may break up enough to bring a few sunny spells. Temperatures of 6 to 8 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, showers to start off this morning. Hopefully those will clear away, and it's looking mostly dry into the afternoon. A few bright spells, temperatures of 6 or 7 degrees. And across Scotland, variable cloud this morning. We'll see a few showers in western and then northern Scotland, a few sunny spells, particularly towards northern and eastern areas, and top temperatures of 5 to 8 Celsius. On Thursday, we're going to see a band of rain moving its way eastward, lingering on across eastern areas of England into the afternoon. Quite cloudy for most, but some sunny spells developing in Wales and southwest England.
Simon, thank you very much. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of December. The headlines this morning: after 5 hours of talks with US envoys in Moscow, the Kremlin says there's no deal on ending the war in Ukraine. We'll see what our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg makes of it all in a few minutes' time. Ministers have hailed new figures suggesting that more patients are now contacting their GPs online than by phone. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting will join us later in the programme. And BBC News has found that the government's response to the COVID inquiry has cost £100 million so far.
Coming up in the next hour, Sarah Everard's mother, Susan, responds to another damning report on violence against women and girls. Her words has been voiced up for us by the actor Tamsin Gregg.
We find we still appreciate the lovely things of life, but without Sarah, there is no unbridled joy. And grief is unpredictable. It sits there quietly, only to rear up suddenly and pierce our hearts.
We'll ask what will lead or what could lead to meaningful change when it comes to the safety of women and girls, especially in public spaces, as Sarah was just walking home. And we'll be speaking with a scientist working out how to get astronauts to Mars without destroying their health. The BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
Talks in Moscow between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's envoys have concluded without a breakthrough in efforts to end the war in Ukraine. Russian officials said the discussions had not brought peace any closer, although it was also no further away. However, the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said some progress had been made. The main sticking point seems to be Russia's demands for Ukrainian territory. While an earlier draft of a US peace deal was reportedly favourable to Moscow, Mr. Putin has described the changes since as unacceptable. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has this report.
According to President Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, the discussions in the Kremlin were very useful, constructive and detailed. But after 5 hours of talks involving Vladimir Putin, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the Kremlin leader did not agree to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Referring to draft peace plans presented by America, Mr. Ushakov said Russia agreed with some points, but some things we criticised. We have not come up with a compromise version yet, he conceded. No compromise is no real surprise, given President Putin's uncompromising statements in recent days. He's shown no desire to make concessions, convinced that Russia has the initiative on the battlefield. And he continues to be scathing of Europe. Ahead of the talks, Mr. Putin said European leaders were under the illusion they could inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. Russia, he said, wasn't planning to go to war with Europe, but if Europe suddenly wants to go to war and starts one, we are ready right now.
The European Union says it has agreed to ban imports of Russian gas by the autumn of 2027. Russia accounts for about 12% of gas imported by member states, down from 45% before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The government has welcomed figures from the Office for National Statistics which suggests that a higher proportion of patients are now contacting their GP surgery online than on the phone. For the past 2 months, all GP surgeries in England have been required to offer a Monday to Friday online booking system, a move resisted by the doctors' union, the BMA. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes has more.
Ending the 8am scramble for a GP appointment is a key government promise. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says figures showing 8 million patients recently used online access demonstrates a big step towards that ambition. ONS data covering 3 weeks from mid-September suggests just over 43% of people went online to contact their GP, compared with 41% via the phone. The Department of Health says that almost every GP practice in England has now rolled out online consultation requests since being required to do so from October. But the move has been resisted by the BMA, which said that GP practices risk being overwhelmed by demand and that patients could be put at risk. The union is in formal dispute with the government over the issue. NHS England says the system makes it easier for patients, and these figures show its popularity.
BBC analysis has found that the government has spent £100 million so far responding to the public inquiry into the COVID pandemic. That's on top of the nearly £200 million the inquiry itself has cost, meaning the total bill is about 50% higher than previously thought. The pressure group, the Taxpayers Alliance, has called the spending a disgrace. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
Responding to the COVID inquiry has been a huge task for the government. On last count, it had nearly 250 staff from different departments providing evidence to the inquiry, alongside legal teams who have been brought in. BBC analysis of Cabinet Office documents suggests that in just over 2 years, the government has spent £101 million on its response. Sources at the inquiry have questioned the government's approach, saying at times it has been hostile and difficult. In 2023, the inquiry and the government even ended up in court over the release of Boris Johnson's messages and notebooks. The Cabinet Office said it was committed to the inquiry and helping learn lessons from the pandemic.
A parliamentary inquiry into the collapse of the trial of two men accused of spying for China has found no deliberate efforts in government to obstruct the prosecution. Instead, the report by MPs and Lords on the National Security Strategy Committee blames systemic failures. Our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford has the details.
Christopher Cash and Christopher Berry were due to go on trial in October, accused of spying for China. But a few weeks before, prosecutors decided to drop the case. This led to some newspapers and MPs accusing the government of deliberately collapsing the trial to protect the UK's relationship with China. The National Security Strategy Committee has now concluded there wasn't a coordinated high-level effort to end the prosecution. But the peers and MPs found what they called a shambolic process, beset by confusion. The prosecution team wanted the Deputy National Security Advisor, Matthew Collins, to state that China posed an active threat to national security. But despite him making three statements, none said exactly that. Nonetheless, the committee said it was surprised that prosecutors concluded that the evidence was insufficient to put before a jury.
A year after an attempted coup in South Korea, President Lee Jae-myung has warned that there's still much to do to ensure it doesn't happen again. In a national address, he praised the South Korean people for defying an attempt to impose military rule, saying they were worthy of a Nobel Peace Prize. President Lee warned that there was still much to do to deal with the fallout.
Strict punishment for the perpetrators of the pro-regime coup is only the beginning. The recklessness of those who try to destroy the constitutional order and even plan a war, all for their personal ambition, must be brought to justice. But just as treating cancer by removing the cancer cells that have taken root deep inside the body, it cannot be completed that easily.
12,000 properties in Kent and East Sussex are without water for a fifth day because of a problem at a treatment works in the Tunbridge Wells area. South East Water says it's working with local councils and other organisations to find the best solutions for those who still don't have supplies. 2,000 homes and businesses were reconnected yesterday. A BBC investigation has found that more than 2,000 extremely abusive social media posts, including death and rape threats, were sent about managers and players in the Premier League and Women's Super League in a single weekend. Four-fifths of the abuse was on X. Here's our sports correspondent, Natalie Perks.
The analysis, conducted with the data science company Signify, focused on more than 500,000 posts on X, Instagram, Facebook and TikTok, uploaded during 16 men and women's top flight matches on the second weekend in November. 2,015 messages were found to be so abusive they broke the platform's own guidelines. They included racist slurs, threats of violence and homophobia. Nearly 40 messages were so egregious they required further investigation, and more than 60% of all verified abusive messages were sent from accounts in the UK and Ireland. Meta's removed one of six flagged posts so far. Signify says X has acted in some form on the 37 messages it flagged.
The first German state visit to the UK in 27 years begins today at Windsor Castle. The King and Queen will host President Frank-Walter Steinmeier for the three-day trip. He'll address Parliament and lay a wreath in the ruins of Coventry Cathedral, which was bombed during the Second World War.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's 9 minutes past seven. High-stakes US-Russia talks on ending the war in Ukraine failed to yield a breakthrough. That's as the Kremlin said no compromise had been found on the key question of territory. But Russian representatives have described those talks from yesterday between President Putin and US envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who's, of course, the president's son-in-law, as productive and useful. But were they? Here's how President Trump described the state of play last night.
Not an easy situation, let me tell you. What a mess.
And that comes hot on the heels of President Putin, ahead of these talks, issuing a warning to Europe, saying European leaders were under the illusion they could inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. With Russia, he said, not planning to go to war with Europe, but if Europe suddenly wants to go to war and start one, we're ready right now. Steve Rosenberg is our Russia editor. Steve, what is the state of play on those talks, first of all?
Well, as Mr. Ushakov, Vladimir Putin's foreign policy advisor, said, we're neither further nor closer to resolving the crisis. I mean, no agreement on a peace deal after those talks. And from what Mr. Ushakov said after the discussions, you know, the two sides discussed documents, in other words, draft peace plans. He spoke in the plural, and that Russia had agreed with some things, but some things Russia had criticized, had a negative attitude to, and that no compromise version of a plan had appeared. He specified that territorial issues were discussed and that without the resolution of those, we don't see resolution of the crisis. And territory is a key question on which it seems there's still no agreement. You know, the Russians... Yeah, Russia invaded Ukraine. It's been seizing Ukrainian land, but it's been demanding also that Ukraine hand over to Russia even more territory, land that Russia has so far been unable to occupy militarily, those parts of the Donbass, which are still under Ukrainian control. That is unacceptable for Kiev. But there's also the question of international recognition of Russia's territorial gains. The Russians have reportedly been pushing for America and maybe also Europe to officially recognise as Russian Ukrainian land that Russia has seized.
But when we hear President Trump saying, you know, what a mess, it doesn't sound hugely optimistic. 5 hours of talks, how you've just described what's been said afterwards. What is that sense of optimism or pessimism at the moment?
No, there's not much optimism. What does all of this tell us about Vladimir Putin? That is the key question, I think. And I think, you know, based on 5 hours of talks in the Kremlin that produced no deal, based on his uncompromising remarks to reporters yesterday that you mentioned about Europe ahead of the talks, based on Vladimir Putin's recent TV appearances and military fatigues, you know, talking to commanders about preparing for winter operations, trumpeting alleged Russian military successes, all of this tells us, I think, that after nearly 4 years of war, despite, you know, the huge losses Russia has suffered on the battlefield, the damage to the Russian economy, Vladimir Putin believes that now he is winning this war and that now is not the moment to stop. Now, I've said before that in some ways Vladimir Putin reminds me of a car that has no brakes and no steering wheel and no reverse gear, a car that's sort of careering full speed down the motorway. And that remains the case because there is no sign right now of the Putin-mobile turning off or turning back or coming to a halt. He doesn't seem to believe, I think, that Europe can do anything to make him change direction, or that America is prepared to put pressure on him to do that, or that Ukraine can hold out indefinitely. So the question becomes, well, at what point does he stop? You know, when he has control of all of Ukraine?
Isn't that also key, what you're saying there about America and the role here and the decision, or you know, whether it's lack of or strategic, we don't know, to engage like this, and what that does in terms of potentially emboldening him?
Absolutely. I tell you one interesting point that I noticed yesterday. The foreign policy advisor said that at the talks, Vladimir Putin had sent a number of important political signals to President Trump, which the US delegation had noted down. Now, what were those signals? What do they refer to? That could be quite a crucial question. It's interesting that there's been no reaction yet post-negotiations from President Trump, you know, to the Moscow talks. No Truth Social post that I've seen, no comments. And I expect that that will come at some point. It'll be interesting to hear his reaction to those discussions and to whatever political signals he may have received. But we do know that as well as political signals, there were probably economic signals sent too. The Kremlin has said that at the talks, Russia and America discussed, quote, the huge prospects for future economic cooperation between the two countries. We talked about this a lot before at previous meetings, Mr. Ushakov said, adding that yesterday it was emphasized that if we wish to cooperate, and there are huge possibilities for this, Moscow and Washington need to demonstrate a real desire for this. And I wonder, is that the Kremlin saying to America, get a move on? We're offering you great economic opportunities here. Don't miss the boat.
Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor. Thank you.
And that brings us to 7:15. The government is telling us this morning that its plans to get GPs' appointments available to more people without having that mad rush at 8 o'clock is working. The ONS, the Office for National Statistics, telling us as well today that for the first time more people use online ways of contacting GP offices than by phone. It sounds like progress, but is it? The Doctors' Union, the BMA, says it isn't. And we can talk now to Jess Harvey, who is a Shropshire GP, a member of the BMA, and someone we talk to pretty regularly on all matters to do with GPs. Good morning to you, Dr. Harvey.
Morning, thanks for having me on.
Give us a sense of what it is that the government is expecting from GPs when it comes to online contact with members of the public.
Yeah, listen, I think in general practice, we're really agile, we're very responsive, and we're totally there in terms of wanting to develop and change to accommodate our patients' needs. But I think to explain what's happening with the online consults, I guess, if you think of the analogy of if you've got a heart surgeon and say she can do two big operations a day, and then somebody says, okay, well, you can do those two, but actually we'd also like you to squeeze in these other two because they're a bit easier, but can you just squeeze them in as well within the same time frame? I'm not sure how many people would want to be having that surgeon. I guess the other way to try and explain what's happening is if you imagine a hairdresser who takes 45 minutes to do a haircut, for example, and then somebody says, okay, well, actually, you can do so many of those cuts a day, that's fine, we'll carry on doing those, but also can you fit in a few trims in between, but I want you to also spend 45 minutes doing those, and people who do the trim still want a decent trim. And then if you imagine that there's an online booking system and there's a free-for-all and no one can see what's booked in already, so the trims get booked in an incredible amount. So that's what's happening, really, is that we're already saturated and working at full capacity, and now essentially there is like an open floodgate, if you like, for people to contact us. Now, we completely understand that people want to contact us, and obviously that's what we want to do. We want to be responsive and to meet our patients' needs, but there's also a reality here in that we have to work safely, and having the endless and ever-increasing numbers that are coming through means that we're struggling to work safely with the number of patient contacts that we should be doing.
Give us an example, then, of where you think this might be unsafe, the kind of case that there would be.
Well, essentially, we have, so say for my practice, we've got GPs who are doing an emergency doctor list, doing routine lists for patients. We've got people who are doing the online consult list, but the online consult list is getting increasingly longer to try and do. So now there's a delay in us being able to do that. Because I've got GPs that are all working full sessions, so they're all doing that. But then if we've got more and more of these online consultations coming in, we can't cope with getting through them in a timely fashion. So instead of having a sort of 24, 48-hour turnaround for them, we're lucky if we can do it in three or four days now, because there are so many coming through.
And presumably there is a risk that, I mean, a lot of those things won't be very serious, but some of them might be.
Yeah, absolutely. And what the problem is, I think the government have created unrealistic expectations for patients. And I'd really welcome an engagement with them in terms of actually really considering the impact that this is having on us and on patient safety. I am by no means averse to working hard. I think all of general practice, you know, we work incredibly hard. We are responsive. We do want to change with the times. We can completely recognise that online consultations are a really convenient way for some people to reach
us. Sorry to interrupt, but I think on that, and we were going to talk to West Reading at 10 past 8 and we'll put this to him, but I think if he were here now, what he'd say is, well, we are increasing the numbers of GPs. We're going full steam ahead with what we can, and we have already, he would say, trained more GPs, got more GPs into the system. So this is just to cope with that.
It's one thing training more GPs, but unless I've got the funds to employ those GPs, it kind of becomes irrelevant how many they train unless they fund general practices to be able to employ these GPs. So it's going back to the hairdresser, is that unless you're getting, you know, unless they're getting an increased amount, then they can't book, then they can't have an additional hairdresser to do those additional cuts. So we aren't having an additional income. So if they want us to do this extra work, it has to be funded for it to be done safely. Or we need to create a realistic expectation for those patients that we can work safely and they can have safe treatment.
Okay, well, look, we will put that to West Reading when we talk to him at 10 past 8 for the time being. Jess Harvey, Dr. Jess Harvey, thank you.
It's 20 past 7, and the boss of one of the UK's biggest wealth managers says speculation in the run-up to the budget had damaged people's pensions. Sean Farrington's back with more. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Yes, hello. Mark Fitzpatrick is the chief executive of St James's Place, which is listed on the FTSE 100, manages nearly £200 billion worth of investments. And he told me that hundreds of thousands of people had drawn down on their pensions prematurely in recent months because they're worried about what the Chancellor could announce in the budget. I asked Mark Fitzpatrick how he found the weeks leading up to that budget.
Ultimately, what we are looking for, and I think what any CEO is looking for, and I believe any and every consumer, everybody living in the UK is looking for, is certainty, clarity, and an element of consistency. And we need that in the run-up to a budget, and we need that post a budget. The run-up to the budget this time was almost long, was longer than last year. And there was a lot of speculation last year. There was a lot of speculation this year. My ask to the government has been one of try and limit periods of speculation, because people act on speculation. And if they take money out of their pension prematurely, then they've damaged their pensions going forward.
Did that happen?
And it happened last year significantly. Hundreds of thousands of people drew down prematurely. This year as well, it's happened. So people's pensions have been damaged due to the speculation. It's thanks to advisors that actually they have encouraged clients not to take out their tax-free cash to support them through this journey. And we're getting a lot of clients saying, thank goodness you encouraged me not to take that money out because I would have made a mistake.
Have you told the government that people's pensions are being hit by the speculation as you've just laid out?
The government is aware.
And what do they say to that?
The government is aware. The government desperately tries to ensure there is one fiscal event a year, and they try and hold on to the key messages for the main fiscal event for the budget. But the speculation that has been out, the flying of kites, is unhelpful when it affects people's lives. It's so important for pensions, which are long, long-term investment, where people are saving for 30, 40 years, to have confidence in that. Because when you retire, Sean, you want to know that actually your pension is going to be intact. so that you and your family have something to live off, to enjoy, because you're working hard now and you want to know that you can retire well. Picking away at that every year is incredibly unhelpful.
The Treasury spokesperson, when we put that to them, made the point to us that they do not comment on speculation around tax changes ahead of a budget. You can hear plenty more from the chief exec of St James's Place in the latest episode of the Big Boss Interview on BBC Sounds.
Sean, thank you. It's 23 minutes past seven. A parliamentary inquiry into the collapse of the trial of two men accused of spying for China has found no deliberate efforts in the government to obstruct the prosecution. But will this verdict quieten those newspapers, MPs and individuals who accuse the government of deliberately collapsing the trial to protect the UK's relationship with China? The National Security Strategy Committee has now concluded there wasn't a coordinated high-level effort to end the prosecution. Instead, the report by MPs and Lords on that committee blames systemic failures. Well, I can talk now to the chair of the Joint Committee on National Security Strategy and the Labour MP, Matt Weston. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
The government is still firmly pinning the blame on the Crown Prosecution Service. When you look across this, as you have, who is truly at fault?
Well, I think we found concerns really across the piece that there was poor communication between the government and the CPS. We think there's systemic failure through it. The whole process looks pretty shambolic. So we wouldn't pin blame on any one individual or one element, but we did find problems throughout.
You did find problems throughout, sorry. I was just checking that was at the end of what you wanted to say. Because there are those who have raised those concerns that I mentioned, who believe the government deliberately collapsed the trial. Do you think this will put paid to those concerns?
Well, I hope so. You know, people always want to try and find conspiracy in this, but we took evidence from government, from CPS. We took evidence from former attorney generals and former national security advisors. And really, there was no sense that there had been any form of conspiracy or leaning on by government, which I think some commentators were keen to establish. But the decision was made, we established on the 22nd of August, when the first senior Treasury counsel met with the star witness and concluded then that actually there was insufficient evidence and that that star witness was not prepared to say what the counsel, or rather the CPS, rather, wanted them to say in court.
But in terms of it, the report itself, I mean, it's still pretty damning, isn't it? I mean, both government and CPS criticised for confusion, misaligned expectations. It hardly makes for a positive read.
Well, as I said, I mean, it looks the report is very clear in its findings that we found this all pretty shambolic. And, you know, there was understandably huge public interest and concern by this. And at the outset, there was the belief that this was a nailed-on conviction, that there was sufficient evidence. But as the case developed, we found evidence that there were long periods when there was no communication, seemingly, between government and CPS, that the witness who had who was established as the Deputy National Security Advisor was not prepared to state categorically that China was an enemy. And then even when there was a separate case that was heard, a case that's referred to as the Rousseff case in 2024, that some believed that it would have been easier to prosecute the two alleged of espionage. But in fact, it made it, in the eyes of the Director of Public Prosecutions, more difficult to do because you needed to demonstrate that at the material time, China posed an active threat to UK national security.
Well, there's still that big question around what should Britain's relationship be with China, which we'll continue to explore. Matt Weston, who's chair of the Joint Committee on National Security Strategy, has produced that report, and a Labour MP. Thank you.
27 minutes past seven. To the sport, here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. Let's start, shall we, with what the BBC Sport website this morning is calling chaos at the cottage.
Chukwueze shoots! Well, the roof has come off! How about this? Two goals from the substitute, and Manchester City are in real danger here. Fulham 4, Manchester City 5. And how on earth has this game turned like this?
Yes, a nine-goal thriller in West London last night. Fulham were 5-1 down to Manchester City, but got it back to 5-4. They then had one cleared off the line, which would have made it 5-5. In the end, Manchester City did hold on for the win. The other notable thing about that match at Craven Cottage was Haaland's 100, Manchester City's Erling Haaland becoming the quickest player to reach 100 Premier League goals, doing so in 111 games. Elsewhere, a 95th-minute overhead kick from captain Christian Romero saw Tottenham draw 2-2 at Newcastle, whilst England's women rounded off a memorable year with a 2-0 friendly victory over Ghana in Southampton. Next to York and a shock at the UK Snooker Championship yesterday.
Well, can you believe it? What a match in the end. Ronnie's up out of his seat.
And for the very first time, Zhou Yulong beats Ronnie O'Sullivan. He defeats Ronnie O'Sullivan 6-4.
You know, defeat's defeat, isn't it? You know, you just have to just accept it's part and parcel of being a professional sportsman, you know?
When will we next see you in the UK? Have you decided about the Masters?
No, not really. I'm going to have a nice Christmas, enjoy that, and just see how I feel come January, you know?
Eight-time winner Ronnie O'Sullivan knocked out of the UK Championship yesterday, beaten in the first round, as you heard, by China's Zhou Yulong. The BBC's Jamie Broughton was watching that match at New York Barbican. Joins us now. Morning, Jamie.
Morning, Mike.
Did you see this coming?
I wasn't surprised, if I'm being honest. He didn't look match sharp. I mean, he's not played much this season. In fact, before the match, he said, you know, I may be a bit rusty because I haven't played that much, although I am pretty happy with my form so far this season. He's already been in the final of one big Branky event, but that's the big question mark for Ronnie O'Sullivan. Does he want to play in enough tournaments so he is match sharp, so he doesn't lose these sort of matches? Because at times in the match, he missed an awful lot of balls he would normally pot. And then in other moments, he looked brilliant when he got amongst the balls. But you have to play and be match sharp at this level. The standard's too high now for you to get through those matches all the time when you're not sharp.
We heard him being a little bit non-committal there, didn't we, about whether he will play at the next big event, the Masters, next year. Where is Ronnie at overall, do you think? He's got a big birthday coming up, hasn't he, on Friday? He turns 50. As he heads into that and 2026, where do you think his head's at?
Well, at the World Championship early this year, he said that he was going to give everything to it, snooker, for the next 2 years and see where he's at. I think that's the case. He certainly seems to be in a good place. He's very happy. He's now moved to Dubai. He's settled there with his wife. But it comes back to how committed he is to playing in all these tournaments. If you look at his contemporaries that are still challenging and winning big tournaments in their 50s, like John Higgins and Mark Williams, who became the oldest ranking event winner earlier this season, they're playing on tour quite a lot now. So, you know, whether or not he's going to do that, whether or not he's going to play at the Masters, he's pulled out of the Masters before. I suspect we probably will see him at the Masters quite often. He likes to hint that he might not play, but, you know, he said he'd like to, but he's going to leave the decision quite late.
We shall see. Jamie Broughton in York this morning. Many thanks. You can watch continuing coverage of the UK Snooker Championship on the BBC iPlayer. As we say, Ronnie turns 50 on Friday. In another interview yesterday, he was asked what he's going to do to celebrate turning 50 on Friday. Do you know what he said?
Go on.
Go to the gym. Could
Come
you
on.
Imagine anything worse?
I didn't think that was going to be the answer. Mike, thank you very much. Now, to tell us about this evening's Moral Maze, Michael Burke, morning.
Morning, Emma. It would be perhaps a cheap shot to suggest that the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, who famously told Mastermind that Henry VIII was succeeded by Henry VII, has little sense of history. But his plan to do away with juries in all but serious cases upends ancient liberties going back nearly 1,000 years. The aim is to clear an enormous backlog that's pushed the average wait for a trial to nearly a year. But the argument against is moral as much as legal. Juries ensure that the law is not the preserve of rulers and that ordinary citizens have a voice in public life. The jury's out on the Moral Maze after the news at 8 tonight.
Michael, thank you. Look at the weather. It's going to be a variable cloud today. Occasional showers moving in from the west. It will be breezy.
And coming up in the next half hour, we've asked some friends of the programme what can be done to save England cricketers Ash's performance.
What I recommend for the England team is that they plug in their earbuds and play an inspiring song.
Four up from
from the ashes, up from the ashes, grow the roses of success.
It's some advice from Sir Stephen Fry there, ahead of the second test starting tomorrow.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. It's 28 minutes to 8. Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio says some progress has been made in talks with Russia to end its war with Ukraine. The meeting in Moscow between President Putin and US envoys ended after 5 hours last night. A Kremlin spokesman said the meeting was constructive, but parts of the plan remained unacceptable to Russia. New figures from the Office for National Statistics suggest that a higher proportion of patients are now contacting their GP surgery online than on the phone. For the past 2 months, all GP surgeries in England have been required to offer an online booking system, a move resisted by the doctors' union, the BMA. The public inquiry into the COVID pandemic has cost the government more than £100 million to respond to so far. That's on top of the nearly £200 million the inquiry itself has cost, meaning the cost to taxpayer is about 50% higher than previously thought. Several people have been taken to hospital for carbon monoxide exposure following an incident in Hastings. East Sussex Fire and Rescue Service were called to an address in the town yesterday evening and found high levels of the gas coming from a generator at a commercial premises. Nearby flats were evacuated. 7 people were taken to hospital. Thames Water has swung back into profit for the most recent six-month period. Bill increases in April boosted revenue 42%. However, the company also sank further into debt, with outstanding loans just shy of £20 billion. For the first time in 27 years, the German president is making a state visit to the UK. Frank-Walter Steinmeier will be hosted by the King and Queen at Windsor Castle. Over the next 3 days, he'll address Parliament, attend the V&A Museum in London, and lay a wreath in the ruins of Coventry Cathedral, which was bombed during the Second World War.
Chris, thank you. It's 26 minutes to 8. I cannot get past the horror of her last hours. The words of Sarah Everard's mother, Susan, in a new statement released in response to a report on combating violence against women and girls, more than 4 years after her daughter was abducted, raped and murdered by a Metropolitan Police officer as she was just walking home. The report published by Lady Angelini yesterday found that sex predators are still escaping detection and prosecution for sexually motivated crimes due to police inaction, a scattergun approach to reform, and a failure to consistently record such reported crimes by police forces in England and Wales. She warned in the report that women's lives are at stake in public places. We wanted you to hear Susan Everard's statement in full. It's been voiced for us by the actor, Tamsin Gregg.
I read that you shouldn't let a tragedy define you. But I feel that Sarah's death is such a big part of me that I'm surprised there is no outer sign of it, no obvious mark of grief. I have been changed by it, but there is nothing to see. Outwardly, we live our normal lives, but there is an inner sadness. People who do know are unfailingly kind and have helped more than they will ever know. We're not the only ones to lose a child, of course, and we form a sad bond with other bereaved parents. After 4 years, the shock of Sarah's death has diminished, but we're left with an overwhelming sense of loss and of what might have been. All the happy, ordinary things of life have been stolen from Sarah and from us. There'll be no wedding, no grandchildren, no family celebrations with everyone there. Sarah will always be missing, and I will always long for her. I go through a turmoil of emotions, sadness, rage, panic, guilt, and numbness. They used to come all in one day, but as time goes by, they're more widely spaced, and to some extent, time blunts the edges. I'm not yet at the point where happy memories of Sarah come to the fore. When I think of her, I can't get past the horror of her last hours. I'm still tormented by the thought of what she endured. We find we still appreciate the lovely things of life, but without Sarah, there is no unbridled joy. And grief is unpredictable. It sits there, quietly, only to rear up suddenly and pierce our hearts. They say that the last stage of grief is acceptance. I'm not sure what that means. I am accustomed to Sarah no longer being with us. But I rage against it.
Susan Everard's statement in full that had been voiced for us by the actor Tamsin Gregg. Farinaz, aunt of 35-year-old Zara Alina, who was sexually assaulted and murdered as she was also just walking home in 2022 by a man who'd been released 9 days earlier from prison on licence, joins us now. Farah, just to remind our listeners, thank you very much for being with us. I imagine it's very difficult to hear those words. It was found the man in question should have been assessed as a high-risk offender, shouldn't have been free to roam the streets. I just wanted to remind our listeners of some of the circumstances of Zara's death and murder and the fact that it shouldn't have happened. What is your response, first of all, to what Susan Everard has had to say in response to this new report?
good morning. Snakes, painful statement to hear. Of course, it's a reminder that...
I'm so sorry. I don't wish to interrupt you, of course, but our connection seems to have fallen down a little. So we're just going to see if we can improve that. It's important to hear what you were saying a little bit. We could hear there of your response to what Susan Everard has had to say 4 years on since the abduction, rape and murder of her daughter, Sarah Everard, which of course prompted so many women to take to the streets and to talk about reclaiming them. And yet this report, which is the second part of the KC's report into violence against women and girls, specifically as well into public spaces, has found that not enough is being done, not least because of failure to record such reported crimes, and also that sex predators are still escaping detection in the first place. Farah, I'm hoping we can hear you now.
Is that better?
Yes, let's give it a go. I hope so. You were just saying, and I'm so sorry to have cut across, your response to what Susan Everard has to say.
of course, there's no reclaim that makes what happened to Sarah anything other than a horror. And we do share that experience. The impact is irrevocable and permanent. And the launch of this report is both painful and necessary. My thoughts go out to Sue and Jeremy Everard and their family.
We're just going to see again if we can improve the line. We did sort of get that. I'm incredibly sorry because it's so important what you have to say, and it's incredibly frustrating for you and for us that we can't quite hear it. But your thoughts going out to Sarah Everard's parents and how important, I suppose, this report is, because we're also trying to think about this morning, especially the family of those who have been lost, is, you know, what can be done and what isn't being done. So Farah, let me just try again. I'm hoping it may be slightly better. When you hear this report as well as what Susan Everard has to say, what is your response to that? Farah, hello. Farah, is that...
Yes.
Sorry, I'll try another time. I was just trying to ask your response to the report, and there's still that there are these significant issues around detection and recording of crimes leading to women's safety being at stake in public spaces. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. The report highlights proper vetting, consistent investigation of sexual offences, perpetrator-focused prevention.
I do apologise to you most of all, but also to our listeners. If we can improve the line, we will do so. Let's leave it just for now and we'll try to return you. Farinaz there, the aunt of 35-year-old Zara Alina, who was murdered when she was just walking home.
Let's turn at 18 minutes to 8. Thought for the day. The speaker here in the studio this morning, the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith, who's the Superintendent Minister of Wesley's Chapel and Lazian Mission. Good morning.
Good morning, Justin. On a Monday morning last July, I stood with others in the Grand Council Chamber of my local town hall and took the oath to become a citizen of the United Kingdom. We had worked hard to be there, every one of us. We had taken the Life in the UK test, filled in forms, assembled documents, attended interviews, and paid our fees. As part of the ceremony, the presiding officer read a charge about the obligations we were undertaking. Prominent among them was the duty to serve on a jury. This obligation will not change, whatever the outcome of proposed reforms to the system of trial by jury in England and Wales this week. But listening to the argument and counter-argument about the reforms has led me back to some basic observations about this country's legal heritage. Part of the Christian inheritance underpinning our democracy is the notion that each person is endowed by God with a conscience, with will and judgment, the ability to know right from wrong and choose between them. In Christian teaching, this does not come from faith in God, but is part of how we are created. We have the capacity for wise judgment because of the image of God in us, not because we belong to a church or carry the label of a particular faith. Thus, a wise jury made up of our fellow citizens, or for that matter a wise judge or magistrate, is possible. Christian scripture gives many examples of communities or individuals exercising that wisdom. However, an equal Christian inheritance underpinning our democracy is the reality that humans are deeply flawed. We make wrong judgments through misunderstanding or malice, narrow vision, self-interest, or soft thinking. Scripture is equally full of examples of communities, judges, or rulers presiding over extraordinary miscarriages of justice. Jesus himself would be judged many times, and yet, when thrust into the role of judge himself, confronted by a mob ready to stone a woman to death, he did not say, "Put down the stones," but, "Let the one without sin cast the first one." And she had done the thing of which she was accused, which was adultery, though presumably not on her own. I can think of no better demonstration that with Jesus, justice is always more nuanced than what happens in courtrooms, important though they are. Justice belongs to and begins with each person in a community, long before we get to juries and judges. Whatever happens with the reforms proposed this week, I hope the debate reminds us that our democracy depends equally on our capacity for good and our humility about what we get wrong.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith, Superintendent Minister of Wesley's Chapel and the Lazy Mission. I should just say at 7:45, we will be working to get Farah Naz back onto the line to respond to that latest report on violence in women and girls after hearing the very powerful statement in full from Susan Everard.
Let's turn to cricket matters. The second Ashes test getting underway in Brisbane, of course, tomorrow morning. Must win for England after they got thumped by Australia in the first match. The BBC's cricket supremo, Jonathan Agnew, describes it as the worst defeat of an England team I've seen in a test in this country being Australia. They should have won. Instead, the game was tossed away calamitously and feebly. If England go 2-0 down, jobs and careers will be on the line. So, to combat the gloom and trepidation, we've asked friends of the Today programme for their ideas on how to save England's ashes. First, a familiar voice.
My name is Amol Rajan. I present the Today programme and also Britain's most exciting podcast, though please don't tell my colleagues. It's called Radical, and I have a radical idea. I believe that I, and I alone, can save England, the country I love, by heading to Australia, joining the Test Match squad, and reminding my fellow players how to actually bat. My credentials are immense. I spent my childhood trying to become England's answer to Shane Warne. It's true that in this endeavour I was wholly unsuccessful, but my ambition could not be faulted. Moreover, I know which end of a bat to use, and as marathon presenting stints alongside Nick Robinson demonstrate, I love the long haul. I will bat for 5 sessions. Not 5 minutes. And while I have never recovered from the trauma of being taken for 28 off one over at Battersea Ironside circa 1996, I believe that my effortful leg breaks will lull our rivals into a false sense of security and cause them eventually to tremble with fear. It'll be like Bodyline a century on, just minus the athleticism and bruises. Indeed, I feel that all my past life has been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. Finally, though I have yet to consult them, I am in no doubt that my divine wife and 4 young children are thrilled at the prospect of my apricating in the Antipodes while they endure an English winter.
Well, what I recommend for the England team is that they plug in their earbuds and play an inspiring song. And the song I recommend is the Sherman Brothers' masterpiece from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, memorably sung by Lionel Jeffries, which actually references the Ashes themselves. And it goes something like this. I'm not going to sing it, but here are some of the lyrics. Every abysmal failure makes a point. So every time you stumble, never grumble. Next time you'll bumble even less. Up from the ashes grow the roses of success. From the ashes of disaster grow the roses of success. Good luck.
G'day from Australia, where England are 1-0 down and on the wrong side, it would seem, of history. But the thing about this England team, they don't care about history. Going 1-0 down is exactly the kind of setback that they've repeatedly shown themselves brilliant at overcoming. Because over the past few years, under Ben Stokes, under Brendan McCullum, they only have to see a precedent to ignore it. They only have to see a record to break it. And I am sure that they will quite correctly be telling themselves that at Perth, England were ahead for long stretches of the game. So I think they need to keep the Bazball faith. There is no going back now. It's death or glory. And I hope it's glory.
That was the historian, one of this year's Today guest editors as well, Tom Holland. Before that, you heard Sir Stephen Fry, and you also heard the renowned podcaster, Amol Rajan.
It's cricket plan for success. It's 11 minutes to 8. I said we would try, and I'm hoping the line now is better, to return to Farah Naz, aunt of 35-year-old Zara Alina, who was murdered as she was walking home in 2022. We were just hearing the words of Susan Everard, which was read aloud for us, her statement that she's just released in response to a new report about combating violence against women and girls, especially in public spaces, which was voiced for us by the actor Tamsin Gregg. A very powerful statement, which at the heart of it talks about 4 years on from Sarah's abduction, rape and murder at the hands of a Metropolitan Police officer, a serving officer no less, that Susan, her mother, has said she cannot get past the horror of her last hours, and explained where the family are up to with this. Farah, I'm hoping I can hear you now. Good morning again.
Good morning again.
That is much, much clearer. You were giving some of your response, I'm so sorry about that, to what Susan had to say, but also to this new report. Please carry on.
Yes, Susan's statement, so painful and a reminder to us all that families like ours, for families like ours, the impact is irrevocable and permanent. And there is no reframe that makes what happened anything other than a horror. So this report brings pain, but it's also necessary. It's so necessary because it shows how the system failed and still fails to stop dangerous men from roaming the streets.
And in the particular case of your niece, you know, also walking home, what can you say of that, and what should have happened that didn't, and what you'd like to see now?
That patterns in offending need to be better identified and given the proper attention and focus, so that risk is properly assessed and so that dangerous men can not be allowed to roam freely. Systems need to be working properly. Long-term action, coordinated strategy needs to be taken. The report calls out systemic failure, which occurred both in the case of Sarah and Zara. Systemic failure led to their murders.
As in the system in this case with your family was a man who should have been deemed high risk, wasn't, was released and then did this?
Yes. Yes. And patterns in offending weren't
identified and correctly given attention. It was the same in the case of Sarah as well. Patterns in offending are not given that proper laser focus that Dame Angelini talks about in her report.
You've also spoken about and campaigned around the role of bystanders and us, members of the public, haven't you?
Yes. Yes. In Dame Angelini's report, she states that the safety of women in public spaces requires whole society action. And in her words, she says community should feel liberated to act. My proposal for a Good Samaritan law does exactly that. It creates legal duty, a legal duty to act when someone is clearly in danger, offering
protection and obligation. What would that mean? What would that mean, stepping in? Because, you know, I've had discussions like this before, you know, with lots of listeners getting in touch. And there's a lot of fear around doing that or a lack of confidence as to what to do. Because as I understand it, in the case in your family, in Zara's case, several people saw the killer pursue her.
Yes. And other women were pursued who didn't report the stalking as well. and stepping in doesn't mean that you have to put yourself at risk. Stepping in can mean making a phone call to the police. So it's not about putting yourself at risk. Stepping in is not about putting yourself at risk, but sharing civic responsibility. It's about creating cultural change. We all need to be be active bystanders. So the law would protect people stepping in safely. It offer protection and obligation.
And there are similar laws that exist in other countries, aren't there?
Yes, this law exists in states, in some states in the US, in Germany, in Portugal, in part in France and in Italy. It's quite a surprise that we do not have this in the UK.
Taking a step back, if you can, as someone who's very familiar with this in this area and thinking about safety of women, particularly in public spaces, we talk about the domestic space a great deal as well, of course, and you know, the likelihood of the man usually that's going to kill a woman being known intimately to them and often an ex-partner all still with them. But about public spaces, with the state of play as it is from this report and what you know of it, do you think women are safe in Britain in public spaces at the moment? What's your view of that, and also with what's happened to your family?
I think looking at the evidence laid out in this report that's taken 2 years to complete in part two, I think we're being told that women are not safe in public spaces. And they have to be responsible for their own safety. So the state does need to be acting with urgency to make women feel safe. They have a right to feel safe in public spaces.
And also, that doesn't even take in women policing themselves, for instance, not going running late at night or changing their behaviour accordingly to chime with that fear. And again, trying to do what they can, whether it's holding keys in their hand as they walk towards their front door and some of the things that very much came to the fore in and around and does come to the fore around these very tragic cases. Farah, just let me ask you finally, Zara, what was she like?
She was joyful, a wonderful citizen, a great neighbour. A loving daughter and granddaughter, and a real joy to our family.
It's important to hear how people were when they were alive, as well as, of course, the circumstances of their very, in her case, very tragic death. Farah Naz, thank you for bearing with us. I'm so sorry about the line there, but it's very good to hear you loud and clear, the aunt of 35-year-old Zara Alina, who was murdered as she was also walking home, and Farah has been campaigning since 2022 and is continuing to do so around the safety of women and girls in public spaces.
3:08 is the time. Let's hear about a compelling series on BBC Sounds.
In 2021, my career, both in teaching and in writing, was suddenly taken away from me.
To some, the online furore went too far.
I do think it was a bit of a witch hunt.
But to others, it was entirely justified.
The language in this book is so dehumanising.
I'm Katie Razzle, the BBC's culture editor, and in a new series, I'll be finding out what happened across 6 episodes and different perspectives.
All of a sudden, not just books, but sentences and words became political.
Anatomy of a Cancellation from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
To the weather, which comes this morning from Simon King.
Justin, thank you so much indeed. Yes, good morning. We've got a bit of a chilly start out there this morning, and for some of us, some fog to contend with on the morning commute. But for southwest England and southeast England, the fog is just really limited towards northern areas, really around the M4 corridor this morning. It will tend to lift up and clear away. Lots of dry weather with some sunny spells, but it's in southeast England where we've got some showers this morning, and those will become, I think, more confined towards Kent, east and west Sussex, towards Hampshire into the afternoon. So showers, yes, will continue here. Elsewhere, it will be drier and brighter. Temperatures of 8 to 12 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, dense fog across East Wales all the way towards Lincolnshire. That fog is going to take a bit of time before it lifts up and clears away. Then we're looking at some dry weather with some sunshine for most parts into the afternoon. A bit of showers, though, for north and west Wales, and temperatures of 8 to 11 Celsius. Across northwest and northeast England, isolated fog patches this morning, mostly around northeast England. Those are going to lift away. Rather cloudy for most, with some showers, I think, in northwestern parts of England. But there may well be some sunny spells just to the east of the Pennines, where the cloud breaks up just enough. Temperatures of 6 to 8 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland, showers to start this morning, those clearing away. Sunny spells this afternoon. And for Scotland, also some sunny spells in northern and eastern areas.
You're listening to Today.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of December. The headlines this morning: the Kremlin says 5 hours of talks with US envoys in Moscow were useful, but there was no deal to end the war in Ukraine. Ministers are highlighting new research suggesting that patients going online to contact their GPs now outnumber those trying to get through on the phone. And BBC News has found that the cost of the government's response to the COVID inquiry has reached £100 million.
And coming up in the next hour, we'll hear how a play by the late Sir Tom Stoppard led to a breakthrough in cancer treatment. It's truly extraordinary. It's a wonderful letter that's gone into the Times newspaper, and we'll bring you the person behind that letter and the person behind that breakthrough. We've also been asking what can be done to save England's Ashes performance ahead of the second test this morning. Crisis? What crisis? Says Piers Morgan.
I'm completely baffled about why we're having a debate about how to save the Ashes. We've lost one match. Our captain is Benjamin Stokes. Do you think he's really going to lose another one?
Well, let's see. The news is read by Chris Aldridge.
Talks in Moscow between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's envoys have concluded without a breakthrough in efforts to end the war in Ukraine. Russian officials said the discussions had not brought peace any closer, although it was also no further away. However, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio said some progress had been made. The main sticking point seems to be Russia's territorial demands. While an earlier draft of a US peace deal was reportedly favourable to Moscow, Mr. Putin has described the changes since as unacceptable. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has this report.
According to President Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, the discussions in the Kremlin were very useful, constructive and detailed. But after 5 hours of talks involving Vladimir Putin, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the Kremlin leader did not agree to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Referring to draft peace plans presented by America, Mr. Ushakov said Russia agreed with some points, but some things we criticised. We have not come up with a compromise version yet, he conceded. No compromise is no real surprise, given President Putin's uncompromising statements in recent days. He's shown no desire to make concessions, convinced that Russia has the initiative on the battlefield. And he continues to be scathing of Europe. Ahead of the talks, Mr. Putin said European leaders were under the illusion they could inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. Russia, he said, wasn't planning to go to war with Europe, but if Europe suddenly wants to go to war and starts one, we are ready right now.
The government has welcomed figures from the Office for National Statistics, which suggests that a higher proportion of patients are now contacting their GP surgery online than on the phone. For the past 2 months, all GP surgeries in England have been required to offer a Monday to Friday online booking system, a move resisted by the doctors' union, the BMA. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes has more.
Ending the 8am scramble for a GP appointment is a key government promise. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says figures showing 8 million patients recently used online access demonstrates a big step towards that ambition. ONS data covering 3 weeks from mid-September suggests just over 43% of people went online to contact their GP, compared with 41% via the phone. The Department of Health says that almost every GP practice in England has now rolled out online consultation requests since being required to do so from October. But the move has been resisted by the BMA, which said that GP practices risk being overwhelmed by demand and that patients could be put at risk. The union is in formal dispute with the government over the issue. NHS England says the system makes it easier for patients, and these figures show its popularity.
Dr. Jess Harvey, a GP in Shropshire and a member of the BMA, told us the increase in online bookings meant practices were struggling to work safely.
What's happening really is that we're already saturated and working at full capacity, and now essentially there is like an open floodgate, if you like, for people to contact us. Now, we completely understand that people want to contact us, and obviously that's what we want to do. We want to be responsive and to meet our patients' needs. But there's also a reality here in that we have to work safely.
BBC analysis has found that the government has spent £100 million so far responding to the public inquiry into the COVID pandemic. That's on top of the nearly £200 million the inquiry itself has cost, meaning the total bill is about 50% higher than previously thought. The pressure group, the Taxpayers Alliance, has called the spending a disgrace. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
Responding to the COVID inquiry has been a huge task for the government. On last count, it had nearly 250 staff from different departments providing evidence to the inquiry, alongside legal teams who have been brought in. BBC analysis of Cabinet Office documents suggests that in just over 2 years, the government has spent £101 million on its response. Sources at the inquiry have questioned the government's approach, saying at times it has been hostile and difficult. In 2023, the inquiry and the government even ended up in court over the release of Boris Johnson's messages and notebooks. The Cabinet Office said it was committed to the inquiry and helping learn lessons from the pandemic.
A parliamentary inquiry into the collapse of the trial of two men accused of spying for China has found no deliberate efforts in government to obstruct the prosecution. Instead, MPs and Lords on the National Security Strategy Committee blame systemic failures. Their report concludes it was surprising that the Crown Prosecution Service did not proceed with the case. The Labour MP Matt Weston, who chairs the committee, told this programme that both the government and prosecutors were to blame.
We found concerns really across the piece that there was poor communication between the government and the CPS. We think there's systemic failure through it. The whole process looked pretty shambolic. So we wouldn't pin blame on any one individual or one element, but we did find problems throughout.
Thames Water has swung back into profit for the most recent six-month period thanks to bill increases last April. But the UK's largest water and waste company sank further into debt with outstanding loans just shy of £20 billion. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Increases in Thames Water bills have boosted revenue 42% to £1.9 billion since April, with profit of £414 million. But the underlying financial picture is dire, sinking further into debt, and the company is expected to run out of cash early next year. A controversial restructuring plan from a group of its lenders is still under intense discussion with the regulator Ofwat and the Department for the Environment. That plan would see the lenders write off 25% of the money they're owed, with a smaller group of junior lenders' loans written off completely. The BBC understands the lender group is hopeful their plan will get agreement in principle before the end of the year, but has many critics, as it requires some leniency over future fines for pollution and spillage. If the plan is not agreed, Thames Water is likely to collapse into government-supervised administration.
24,000 properties in Kent and East Sussex are without water 5 days after a problem emerged at a treatment works in the Tunbridge Wells area. South East Water says it's working with local councils to find the best solutions for those affected. Simon Jones reports.
South East Water has once again apologised to customers who are still without supplies. But the company is unable to give any timescale for when their water might be restored. A deadline of 6 o'clock yesterday evening was missed. Several schools in the area have been forced to close. Businesses say the loss of water is costing them a fortune. Kidney dialysis patients have been sent to other hospitals, and portable toilets have even been put up in the town centre. More than 600,000 litres of bottled water have been distributed. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, says the government should consider calling in the army to get a grip of the situation. Ministers say South East Water needs to take urgent steps to support those affected.
16 people have been treated for symptoms of carbon monoxide exposure in Hastings in East Sussex. 7 were taken to hospital for checks. High levels of the gas were found coming from a generator at a commercial premises, affecting surrounding flats which were evacuated. Emergency services remain at the scene. A BBC investigation has found that more than 2,000 extremely abusive social media posts, including death and rape threats, were sent about managers and players in the Premier League and Women's Super League in a single weekend last month. 4/5 of the abuse was on X. The company has acted in some form on 37 messages flagged to it. The Chelsea Super League manager, Sonia Bonpastor, was among those targeted in the abusive post.
I think the social media companies are not doing their job, not taking again the responsibility and the accountability for that. And I think as a club, we need to support our players in the best way possible. I think if we have to wait for the social media companies to act, I think we can be in this situation for too long.
For the first time in 27 years, the German president is making a state visit to the UK. Frank-Walter Steinmeier will be hosted by the King and Queen at Windsor Castle. Over the next 3 days, he'll address Parliament, attend the V&A Museum in London, and lay a wreath in the ruins of Coventry Cathedral, which was bombed during the Second World War. The German MP Jürgen Hart is the foreign policy spokesperson of the ruling CDU-CSU parliamentary group.
This is a good opportunity now to strengthen the relations and to underline that we have a new era with the Kensington Treaty, with the friendship treaty between Germany and Great Britain, and that we have challenges to face Russia, Ukraine.
That's the German MP Jürgen Hart.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. To many people, one of the signs that Britain is not functioning as it should is the 8 a.m. scramble for a doctor's appointment. One of the things Labour said it would change was that scramble, and there is evidence today of progress. From the beginning of October, all surgeries have been required to provide an online consultation set up, not just appointments, consultations as well. And it seems that more people are doing that than using the phone. But the doctors' union, the BMA, does not see this as progress at all. And we heard from a doctor an hour ago telling us that for her, the government was creating what she called unrealistic expectations. Let us talk to Wes Streeting, the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care in England, who is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you accept at all that some of the extra work that doctors are being asked to do is not reasonable?
No. I appreciate that. If there weren't patients, the NHS would run more smoothly. But the NHS exists to serve patients. And the truth is that the difficulty that patients have found accessing general practice has led to either late diagnosis or unmet need, or patients are going to other parts of the NHS, like accident and emergency department, experiencing poorer care at a higher cost as a result. And the whole drive behind our modernisation of the NHS is to make sure people get seen in the right care, right place, right time, because that's better for patients and more cost effective for the taxpayer.
Well, a lot of GPs listening, though, will say, well, hang on a second, and this GP said it to us an hour or so ago, we are already hugely overworked. It's not that we regard patients as a nuisance. That's not fair, they'll say. What we want to do is make sure that we actually give a gold-plated service to every patient. And we cannot do that if we've got a ton of stuff coming online that we can't cope with.
I would definitely accept that there have been enormous pressure on general practice and that GPs have been given a bad rep because they have been trying to do their best against the backdrop of a government, our predecessors, who did not invest in or value and support general practice. That's why when we came in, we invested £1.1 billion into general practice. We have taken steps to modernise through online access. And to be clear, we have now got 98.7% of GP practices across England offering online access. Patient satisfaction has risen from 60% when Labour came to office to 75%. So I don't want people to get the impression from the BMA that somehow we've had to do this modernisation against GPs or to GPs. We've done this with GPs. There is a real can-do culture in general practice out there. I think they've been doing a valiant job against the backdrop of real pressures. Satisfaction is improving as a result, but I would accept that whether it's the one in four patients who, by that data I mentioned, are not satisfied, or indeed the GPs who are struggling to cope with demand that's coming in, I would accept there is still more to do, in common with everything else in the NHS, where we are seeing green shoots of recovery, but still more to do. So I don't want to sound complacent. There's more to do. But I also think the BMA does their members a disservice when they are vocally opposing online access, which, by the way, they signed up to in contract negotiations, because I think they are doing a disservice to their members, to GPs who are working with us, not against us.
Talking of your clashes with the unions, we've got the junior doctors, now they're called resident doctors, aren't they? Still planning to walk out December the 17th, the 22nd. It'll be the third round of strikes, 26% pay rise they're demanding as well. Two things that their representatives said on the programme yesterday. Number one, that the pay rise that they're being offered is actually a pay cut in real terms. It's a percentage less than inflation. And number two, that why not give them more posts, more training posts? So he said we've got 30,000 people applying for 10,000 jobs. Why not ease the way for those who want to become junior doctors, resident doctors in this country? Why not ease the way for more of them to do it?
So let's separate those two issues of pay and jobs, and they're both important. Firstly, on pay, they've had a 28.9% pay rise from this government since we came to office. That's the highest in the public sector 2 years in a row. And there'll be few people listening, even to the Today programme, who've had anything like a 28.9% pay rise. So let's just acknowledge that. As for pay in future years, nothing has yet been decided. We'll wait for the outcome of the pay review body process. I'm always happy to talk to NHS staff about the prospect of multi-year deals, but the BMA have to engage within the boundaries of credibility and affordability, and respecting that I am responsible for 1.5 million people who work in the NHS, many of whom, at the height of their career, will never earn as much as the lowest paid doctors. And by the way, whenever this government or previous government have looked at the burden of taxation and how to fund the NHS, some of the first people to complain about any sort of tax increases that impact on higher earners are the BMA.
All right.
Secondly, on jobs, I've got a lot of sympathy for their arguments in this area. So we are looking to increase the number of specialty training places, but also to deal with the absurdity we inherited, where international medical graduates are competing on equal terms with our own homegrown talent for a limited number of training places.
Will you stop now, that?
Yes, but the BMA know full well that the reason why we haven't done it already is because this is riddled with legal complexity, and therefore change to the law is required. That is not straightforward. I'm talking to my counterparts in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. I'm looking at options to see if we can go faster. The BMA know this, which is why it is even more unreasonable that they are choosing, against that backdrop of a 28.9% pay rise, the offer to go further on increasing specialty training places, and knowing that I'm pulling out every stop I can to go faster on on the international medical graduates issue, to now threaten strike action at a time of the year when they know that it is a different order of magnitude of risk when it comes to patients. It is unnecessary, but it is also grossly irresponsible.
Are you able to do business with them, do you think? Because we've had people talking recently, the bosses of NHS England of various guises, saying that this is now a body that they find it very difficult to consider doing business with you. Have you reached that point?
It is extremely hard. I mean, compared to other trade unions, where we've got a really good relationship nationally and also at branch level and at grassroots level, working with NHS staff who've been working, frankly, for years in intolerable conditions. They're working with us because they really care about the NHS and they know how much this matters and how much the survival of the NHS matters. It is very hard to deal with the BMA when they constantly turn over in terms of their leadership, when they have positions that are wildly irrational and unreasonable, and where often they behave more like a cartel than a trade union. And that's what's so difficult.
Couple of other things. First, you've done a deal now as a government with Donald Trump, with Donald Trump's White House, to organise that the medicines from this country, are able to get into the United States without having tariffs put on them. But crucially, in the other direction, we're going to pay more for American medicines here. The King's Fund, I see, is saying $3 billion a year. When it comes in. Does that money come from the NHS budget or will it come separately from the Treasury?
Firstly, I don't recognise a $3 billion figure, so I'm going to have to pore over how on earth the King's Fund have reached that.
Can you tell us what the figure is?
No, because it's highly variable. I mean, I think we're looking more like the order of magnitude of around £1 billion. And also it depends, because this is a hugely, hugely complicated area. It really does depend on the level of medicine spend, the level of rebate, and the level of investment we get in the UK in terms of life sciences.
Well, understood, but can you at least confirm that it will come from the NHS budget? It won't come from anything separate?
We're not going to cut NHS services to fund the pharma deal. What our negotiators...
Where will the money come from?
What our negotiators have achieved is remarkable. They've achieved 0% tariffs. We've dealt with a complicated negotiating environment where we've had a domestic negotiation with life sciences here in the UK at the same time as our life sciences sector and life sciences more broadly have been negotiating with the Trump administration, and we have too. So it's been very complicated. We've all been spinning lots of plates, but we've got to a position which is good for growth and good for patients, because my principal position is I want to make sure that people in this country have access to the latest medicines.
Sure.
I want as much drug discovery to take place here in the UK.
I'm sorry just to press you on this, because I think you are being very clear about it, but just want to be absolutely clear. You are saying that when there is an extra cost to bear, which there will be, whatever that cost is, it will not come out of the existing NHS budget and existing NHS services.
We're not going to cut NHS services to fund
Understood.
This. And by the way, I also think what we're trying to do is to both uphold the strength of the UK and NICE, which is the body that's set up by the last Labour government that drives a hard bargain on price with pharma and has done a brilliant job, with also not seeing medicines as a deadweight cost. They are an investment in the health of the nation.
Just want to get to one other issue, because Kemi Badenoch, Conservative leader, has written to you about it, and this is the puberty blockers trial that's being undertaken by King's College London. What Kemi Badenoch suggests is that it shouldn't be taking place because it is an unacceptable experimentation on potentially very young children, as young as 11 or 12. You yourself, when you banned puberty blockers for the under-18s last December, you said there was an unacceptable safety risk. Are you comfortable with very young children being given drugs when we don't know what impact the drug is going to have on them?
No, I am following clinical advice in this area, and I've tried to do my best to take politics out of this entirely and to resist political pressure wherever it is coming from to do anything other than to listen to our country's best scientists, top paediatricians, and to do the right thing when it comes to the safety and the well-being of children's medicine generally, but particularly in this area where we're also talking about a particularly vulnerable group of children.
But what critics say is that a lot of those scientists have been captured by this idea, as they would put it, that a child can be born in the wrong body, and that actually what Kemi Badenoch says is, no, that can't happen. And what you seem to be suggesting is that the thing does make you concerned as well. You'd rather not do this.
Well, we are following the CAS review commissioned by the previous Conservative government. In opposition, we accepted all of the recommendations and we wanted to work in a bipartisan way. That is the approach we are now taking in government. It was Hilary CAS who sounded the alarm about the prescription of puberty blockers for this purpose, for this patient group, without adequate evidence. She also recommended this trial. And just to reassure people, the process of setting up this trial has gone through some of the most rigorous checks in terms of ethics, safety and clinical oversight. It will not be the case that a child, young person can say, I want to be on this trial, and then they're on it. They have to go through rigorous assessment in terms of their physical health and their mental health. Their parents will need to be involved and consenting. We will need to be sure that parents are not having undue or improper influence over their children in terms of this, in terms of their own ideological viewpoints or standpoints. There will be strong clinical oversight, not just locally, but through national oversight boards and independent advisory groups. So I am satisfied that this trial has been built with ethics and safety at the heart of it. I am concerned about the safety and well-being of children and young people affected by gender dysphoria. And by the way, I do recognise and respect that there are colleagues in Parliament, whether in my party or on the opposition benches, who do not support this trial. And I think what unites everyone across the House of Commons, actually, is a shared determination to make sure we do the right thing by children and young people, by this particularly vulnerable group of children and young people. And what this debate is ultimately about is harm reduction and safety. And the question is the best way to ensure harm reduction and safety for these children, to give them access to medicine like this, or is it not? And that was the basis, I think, upon which Hilary CAS recommended this trial. And I'm following that clinical advice, though I accept and respect that there are good colleagues on both sides of the House of Commons who will have a different view.
Wes Streeting, thank you very much for talking to us. And just before we move on, I mentioned in that interview with Wes Streeting, the chair of the BMA, Tom Dolphin, was on the programme talking about the resident doctor strikes in the run-up to Christmas yesterday. Talking about Christmas, he said, then is a cynical ploy by the employer side. Nick then asked Dr. Dolphin about criticism of the timing of the strikes. He suggested that he, Dr. Dolphin, had used the word sentimental about the desire to spend Christmas with loved ones. And that wasn't right. Dr. Dolphin had in fact told our producer before coming on air that NHS providers' argument about patients spending Christmas with their loved ones was an emotional argument. That was the word he used on air rather than a clinical one. So we apologise to Dr. Dolphin for misquoting him.
It's 25 minutes past eight. A new Christmas tale, which follows a family struggling financially whose cat Pax ventures out into the cold after they cannot afford food for him, is out. It's called, or coming, it's called Pax, A Festive Tale. It's for the Big Issue magazine. It's been penned by Michael Rosen. He, of course, we're going on a bear hunt fame and many other books. Michael Rosen, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. I thought we'd start with an extract from the story to set the scene.
Right, so it starts like this. Can I feed Pax tonight, Mum? Evie was sitting with her legs twined round the table, looking at Pax. Pax was looking at Evie. Mum was heating the beans. Can I? Evie said again. Pax seemed to know what Evie was saying. She looked at her empty bowl, up to Evie, across to Mum, back to the empty bowl. Can I? Evie said yet again. Mum looked away from the beans and up to the ceiling. She didn't finish what she was going to say. Or she couldn't finish what she was going to say. Can I? Evie said yet again. Mum carried the beans to the table. I couldn't. Her voice faded. Evie looked at her, waiting for more. Mum poured the beans out onto Evie's plate. I didn't have enough money, she said. The way she said money sounded flat and dead enough for Evie to know that this wasn't something you could argue with. It was final, a thing said, that landed on the table between them like a spoonful of mash.
Thank you for that, Michael. It's a difficult area, this, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, writing children's books can be, and children's stories, stories that involve children can always be a little bit difficult because you're juggling with various things all at the same time. Yeah.
But the idea of bringing this up in and around Christmas, where, of course, everything is it can seem so plentiful, available, all around what you're buying and getting.
Yes, but then the Christmas story itself, the nativity story and so on, is one of hardship of various kinds, isn't it? And people quite often do focus on that aspect. So I think it's it fits that side of things as well.
Why did you want to do this, and with the big issue?
I was approached. You know, sometimes you write stories because, you know, an idea comes into your head, and I like doing that. And then other times somebody says, well, why don't you have a go at doing this? And you pick and choose those. And when suddenly somebody says, oh, you know, why don't you try that? I thought, oh, yes, that seems like quite an interesting challenge. So I guess all writers might say that. We're sometimes provoked, maybe put it that way.
But I suppose what provoked you into thinking this would be something to do as a challenge and to try and get across? Is it the idea of trying to talk about difficult issues to younger people, finding a way into that, reflecting their lives?
I guess it's partly the context of the magazine itself. I mean, I buy the magazine from somebody who sells it outside my local supermarket. And it seems to me that, you know, given there are gaps in the way the welfare state works, the big issue is one of those gaps that is filled rather cleverly. And I think, as I say, that the story of hardship at the time of Christmas, it all connects, really. So, that was what provoked me. That's what got me going.
And how did you think about writing about difficult times for children in a way that not necessarily can make them always feel better, of course, because the reality may still be the same, but doesn't make them feel worse?
Well, the convention with children's stories is that they're conservative with a small c. That's to say, things resolve. And the something good comes out, and the life goes on in a reasonable way. So it's not like some adult literature, which, you know, if you think of somebody like Kafka, you know, things just get worse and worse. And that, we quite like that as adults, I think. But with children, there is this convention, which I take part in, of pleasant and enjoyable resolutions. So without giving the story away, there is a resolution, and Pax, alert people will have noticed, it's the Latin word for peace, is the peacemaker.
Pax, A Festive Tale with the Big Issue by Michael Rosen, been released, and thank you very much for coming on the programme.
29 minutes past 8. To the sport, here is Mike.
Thank you, Justin. 20 hours to go now until the second Ashes test gets underway in Brisbane. The day-nighter starts at the Gabba at 4 a.m. UK time tomorrow morning. And in the last hour or so, the England captain Ben Stokes has been giving us his final thoughts ahead of the match. So let's hear from him. He's been chatting to Jonathan Agnew, who started by asking how the England team have been reflecting on that embarrassing two-day defeat in the first test in Perth.
Yeah, look, the game finished in 2 days, which is a lot earlier than planned, and important for us to really reflect on that and make sure that we didn't just go right over and done with, move on to Brisbane, because those discussions are so vital in the first step to sort of moving away from that and getting over that and then concentrating on that. And when you have those conversations as a group in an environment which isn't almost like classroom-esque, if that makes sense, you know, the best conversations happen when they're just sort of, you seem to find yourself in the team room together, and then conversation just flows and flows and flows. And yeah, as a team, look, there were moments in that test match where we know that we could have been a lot better, but also there was a lot of real positives to take out of that game. Look, we know that we were ahead of that game for the vast majority of the time.
Which must have frustrated you even more. I mean, the fact that you look back at that and think we should have won that.
Well, definitely. We all know that. Yeah. We all know that that was a game that slipped out of our hands. And, you know, there was some moments in that game that sort of we contributed towards that. And we've done that. We've reflected on all those kind of things. We've looked at those areas where we feel like we could have been a lot better. And then we moved over to Brisbane. And, we had more of an opportunity to get into here to Brisbane. I can't believe, the first thing we felt was when we stepped off the plane was you come into the sun and you just start dripping with sweat. The humidity here was completely different. We've had, this is our now fifth day of training, getting ready for this pink ball game. So Look, we've trained in the normal light, we've trained in the light, so we've prepared very, very well for this, and you know, we've given ourselves a real look at what things might change in terms of, you know, what it's like to bat and bowl under lights and not under lights as well.
But would there be a change? Well, there were some dismissals that were disappointed the batsmen, I think, in Perth. Is that an area that you've really kind of been looking at and trying to improve?
There are, as I've just said, you know, there were moments in the games where, you know, we've all looked back on that, and you know, as a group and as individuals, where we could have been better, as I said. And when we say we're going to stick to our process has been is very simple. It's put teams under pressure, absorb the pressure when it's needed to, chase the ball as hard as you can to the boundary, and leave everything out on the field. That is our process of Test cricket. We could have been better at absorbing that pressure last week. We know that in those, you know, third and fourth innings, not only with the bat but also with the ball, because we know that, you know, when we are on top, we, you know, we're very good at drumming that home. Those moments are the last week are where we could have improved on, definitely, and we all know that, and we speak about that kind of stuff, and we've addressed that, moved on, and yeah, it's all been about Brisbane since we've done that.
Last thought about this game, Ben. A lot hinges on this, isn't it? I mean, you know, 2-0 down would be a very difficult situation to be in. Not that you're considering that, of course, but this is a huge game in the series, isn't it?
Well, yeah, as last week was a huge game, this week's a huge game, every game is a huge game. But in the series of this context, it's massive. We're very, very excited to get going this week, and hopefully we can get the series back to 1-1 and continue from there, mate.
Ben Stokes chatting to Jonathan Agnew in the last hour. Let's have a quick chat with Henry Moran, who's at the Gabba preparing for the second test tomorrow. Hi, Henry.
Hi, good morning.
So Stokes there, admitting some mistakes were made in Perth, but at the same time, England, it sounds like, very much sticking to their guns ahead of the second test.
Yeah, absolutely, and bullish about how they're going to approach things, and I think you can read between the lines the criticisms of England's preparation when he mentioned how hot it is in Brisbane, the humidity, and all those questions as to whether England have got things right coming into this series. Well, he's trying to answer them, but the test is, can they get things right when the game gets underway? They had a huge opportunity in Perth with that first innings lead, good start to their second innings, but they let Australia back in, and they can't afford to be that generous this week, especially at a venue they've not won at since 1986, and you feel it would be very hard to come back into the series. Only one side has ever come back from 2-0 down to win in Ashes, and that was Sir Don Bradman's Australia back in 1937.
Yes, history not on their side. Just briefly, Henry, reminders of the team news. Question mark still over Mark Wood, the England bowler. And what about the Australian captain, Pat Cummings? Might we see him after all?
Well, we've spent much of the day watching Australia's training and body language to try and work it out. He was out there in the middle alongside his deputy Steve Smith and the coach Andrew McDonald. Australia say they'll wait until the toss, so we'll have to wait and see who comes out in their smart green jacket tomorrow morning. As for England, yet that one change, Mark Wood misses out. In comes Will Jacks to strengthen the batting.
Good stuff, Henry Moran. Countdown to the start of the second test. Very much on, as we say, it gets underway 4 a.m. UK time, and you'll be able to follow it all on Test Match Special on BBC Sounds. And I'll be back tomorrow, hopefully with good news throughout the programme. We shall see.
Mike, thank you. Here now is Dr. Sean Williams to tell us what's coming up at 9 o'clock.
Good morning. A powerful story today of beauty emerging from horror. The artist, Edvard Munch, the creator of The Scream, once said, "Art comes from joy and pain, but mostly from pain." My guest might relate to that. Michael Ashcroft was a metalworker from Lancashire, but one day he experienced a moment that made him see himself in a completely different light, one that both fascinated and repulsed him. And it was that which prompted him to down tools and pick up a paintbrush. But even he wouldn't have guessed where it would take him. Join us both for Life Changing after the news at 9.
To the weather, which is not that interesting, to be frank. Variable cloud, occasional showers, more of them in the west. It will be breezy as well. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Emma Barnett, just aware the time is 24 minutes to 9. Chris Aldridge has the news.
The US Secretary of State,
Marco Rubio, says some progress has been made in talks with Russia to end its war with Ukraine, although the Kremlin said there'd been no agreement. The meeting in Moscow between President Putin and US envoys ended after 5 hours last night. Figures from the Office for National Statistics suggest that a higher proportion of patients are now contacting their GP surgery online than on the phone. For the past 2 months, all GP surgeries in England have been required to offer an online booking system, a move resisted by the doctors' union, the BMA. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, told us that the old phone-in system was forcing patients to wait too long for GP appointments. The public inquiry into the COVID pandemic has cost the government more than £100 million to respond to so far. That's on top of the nearly £200 million the inquiry itself has cost. 24,000 properties in Kent and East Sussex are without water 5 days after a problem emerged at a treatment works in Tunbridge Wells. South East Water says it's working with local councils to find the best solutions for those affected.
Thank you for that. It is 23 minutes to nine. High stakes US-Russia talks on ending the war in Ukraine have failed to yield a breakthrough on Tuesday. That is what the news agency Wires are telling us this morning. The Kremlin saying no compromise has yet been found on the key question of territory. Russian representatives there describing the talks between President Putin and the US envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner as productive and useful. But are they? All of it coming hot on the heels, of course, of President Putin ahead of those talks, issuing a warning to Europe, essentially, saying European leaders were under the illusion they could inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. Russia wasn't planning to go to war with Europe, he said, but if Europe suddenly wants to go to war and starts one, we are ready to fight now. Let us hear first from Katja Adler, the BBC's Europe editor.
There's a real sense across Europe that leaders are just watching from the sidelines. I mean, just as an example, you've got NATO foreign ministers meeting today to discuss the US drafted peace plan that they weren't consulted on. And who is not there? The US Secretary of State. There's going to be only a deputy minister representing the alliance's strongest member. One thing I do notice amongst the Europeans, though, who, you know, as we say, have been watching from the sidelines, is this push at the moment with these different, you know, or revisions of peace plans is focusing minds, because Europeans have been quite absolutist by Ukraine's side, saying, you know, Ukraine needs to get all of its territory back. But the fact that Donald Trump seems so focused on finding an immediate short-term solution to Ukraine, this is in European minds, makes them think about the long-term stability of their continent. Can they get together? Can they put their divisions aside and come up with a strategic security plan for Ukraine and the continent, which will include not just the future of a sovereign Ukraine, possibly with some painful concessions for long-term gain? These are the conversations going on behind the scenes. But also, and this is of paramount importance, how to deal with Russia going forward if there is a ceasefire, if there is a peace plan. Whereas Donald Trump can try and end the war in Ukraine and turn his attention elsewhere, Europeans are geographically next to Russia. That's not going to change. How are they going to deal with Moscow in the future?
That was our Europe editor, Katja Adler. And speaking in the last hour, NATO's Secretary General Mark Rutte has been reiterating the alliance's support for Ukraine.
The peace talks are ongoing. That's good. But at the same time, we have to make sure that whilst they take place, and we are not sure when they will end, that Ukraine is in the strongest possible position to keep the fight going, to fight back against the Russians, but also in the strongest possible position when peace talks really get to a point where they sit at the table.
That was NATO's Secretary General talking in the last hour. Let us talk now live to Yuri Sack, used to be an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Defence. We've talked to him many times in the past. Mr. Sack, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you have any hope at all that the talks that were going on yesterday in Moscow and might or might not continue elsewhere, that they're actually leading to something useful?
We were very sceptical from day one when these talks began, because we know that Russia doesn't want peace. Russia wants Ukraine. And Russia confirms this by its actions on the ground. Almost on a daily basis, we have massive missile and drone attacks on Ukraine. I mean, that's not a sign of somebody who wants peace. And of course, by now, Russia is openly saying that, you know, the minimum requirements that they will sign up to are their maximalistic demands, which pretty much are tantamount to requiring Ukraine to capitulate. I mean, that is not, of course, possible. Ukraine will never capitulate. The European partners will never agree to such a peace formula. And actually, the White House also understands that, you know, this is not the way forward. This is why the US and the Ukraine side have met in Geneva a week ago. And then following that, there was, a workable peace plan devised, which was then taken to Moscow. And we have seen that it was rejected. So I think the time has come for Plan B. And what Mark Rutte, to whom you've just referred to, is saying, that's the Plan B, right? Russia, the peace will come when Russia stops fighting, and Russia stops fighting when it no longer can fight. And it will not only, it will not be able to fight if it's exhausted economically. So more economic sanctions, more deep strike capabilities for Ukraine. And of course, the issue of frozen assets. I mean, that's a very actionable tool, which the European countries should get their heads together and resolve. Yeah,
which we've been talking about, I mean, literally for years now.
Yes.
And it never quite happens. Is it any closer, do you think?
Well, you know, I hope it is, because what we have to do, we do 24/7, and now we know that it's Belgium who is the kind of sticking point, and they refuse to release those funds. But again, if we're serious, if Europe is serious about stopping this war, this is almost the first step that needs to be taken, because of course Ukraine will continue to fight for as long as we can. Our president said that, yes, Ukrainians are made of steel, but even the strongest steel breaks sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. So it cannot last indefinitely. But depriving Russia of these frozen assets and using them for Ukraine's defense and reconstruction is a very, very powerful and efficient tool, which is in the hands of the European countries.
I'm very interested in whether you think Donald Trump would walk away if the existing round of talks don't come to anything. Because there's a view, isn't there, that, you know, Europe might have to do this without America at all, and indeed Ukraine might have to do it without any help at all. There's also a view, isn't there, that actually when it comes to it, Donald Trump can't afford not to be involved. What's your sense of what is likely to happen with the White House, assuming these current talks stop?
Well, indeed, the White House now is at a crossroads, and they will also have to decide, because when Donald Trump was inaugurated, he said that, you know, if his peace plan doesn't work, he will apply pressure on the party that will be obstructing the peace. Now, the party who is now obstructing and making peace impossible is Russia. So logically, he should go back to his original plan and exert more pressure on Russia, which means more support for Ukraine, more weapons for Ukraine, and more economic sanctions of different kind on Russia. Moreover, I would say that even if Donald Trump is reluctant to act that way, I think the United States of America in general, they have a bipartisan institutional memory of what happens to America when it abandons its allies. You know, historically, it's never led to anything good. So even if there's some advisors who will be telling him, okay, it's a European war, just forget about it, just focus on domestic issues, make America great again, that is just not possible. The history has shown this so many times. So I think the possibility of the United States of America just walking away and abandoning Ukraine and European allies in this war because of this historic institutional memory is not realistic.
Yuri Sak, former advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Defence, as ever. Thank you.
It's 8:45. 12,000 properties in Kent and East Sussex remain without water in their homes for a fifth day after a water quality issue at a treatment plant in Kent. South East Water has apologised to its customers in and around Tunbridge Wells, who are still experiencing a loss of water or low pressure since Saturday. Yesterday, a dialysis centre confirmed the water supply problem was impacting its kidney treatment centre, and some schools have had to close. Let's first cross to Simon Jones, our South East reporter, who was in Tunbridge Wells last night. Simon, what's the latest?
Well, this is actually a fast-developing story this morning, and the number of properties who now have no water has actually risen to 24,000. So in many ways, it was back to square one, because this issue first occurred on Saturday evening, 24,000 properties affected. Over the past 4 days, South East Water managed to restore supply to half of those properties. But this morning, it says there's been a further problem with water quality. So now those homes who had water restored water them have lost that water again. So 24,000 homes without water. But we have just heard from the water company that they are going to try to restore the supply to everyone at midday. But crucially, there's going to be a notice on this water that people can't drink it. So they can use it to have a shower, they can use it to flush the toilet, but they shouldn't drink it, because the water company is admitting that at the moment it's unable to produce drinking water from its treatment works at Pembrey that meets the regulatory standards required for people to actually drink it.
That's hardly inspirational to have a shower, is it?
No, but I think, having spoken to people in the area over the past 5 days who have had no water at all, it has been really difficult for them. So I think they'll be relieved to have some water back of sorts.
I know, it's just the thought that you can't drink it. And obviously when you are in the shower, it's all over your body. Simon, stay with us. Let me bring in Leanne Dell, who lives in Tunbridge Wells. And your water's been off, is it right, for 5 days, Leanne?
Well, I first noticed it on Sunday morning when I got up. So, yeah, we're now on day five for some people, day four for me.
And tell us what this has been like, and what communication you've had, how it's affected your life.
Well, I mean, from South East Water, they keep moving the goalposts. They keep saying, right, it'll be back on by 6 p.m. tonight. Then you get another message, it'll be on by 6 a.m. tomorrow. So it's broken promises, promises, promises. You know, it makes it very difficult to plan. I know there are some people that said if South East Water had told them the truth in the first place, they maybe could have decided, well, if the water's not going to be on for 4 or 5 days, we'll go and stay with family or friends for 4 or 5 days out of the area. It's just ridiculous. I mean, I'm lucky because I've got friends and I've got a car, so I can get out of the area to go and have a shower. I'm at a friend's house as we speak, having just had a shower at his house, and he lives about 4 or 5 roads from me, so he's got water and I haven't.
And what about your son?
So my son is now on day 3 of no going into school, because the school has no water. They've now resorted to learning on Teams today, but I know that yesterday and the day before they weren't learning on Teams. But you know, it's just ridiculous. He's in year 11, so it was a really important year for him, GCSE year, and it's really impacting kids' education.
And in terms of what you make of this, I mean, you've talked about the communication, but, you know, we've been talking, I suppose, throughout the programme about various structural issues in the country and how things are working. I mean, what's your view of this, having been through this?
Well, my view is, well, I know the local MP who is calling for the CEO of South East Water to resign. I would echo that. I think this has been an absolute disaster from start to finish. I'm not up on what's going on with regards to infrastructure, but obviously something's gone wrong. Mm. I've heard again. My son texted me this morning to say that apparently the water has been contaminated again, which I think I just heard on your radio show. So, you know, God knows when we're going to get our water back. And I have just had a shower in the water that's coming through. So I hope it is safe enough to shower in.
Well, that, I mean, that's the guidance and that's what we were saying. But I suppose it was also just a comment on trust, really, and when it does come back on and how people will feel about drinking it again.
I have no idea how. Well, I guess we'd have to wait for communication to say that it's safe to drink again. But I mean, I think it's absolutely disgusting. It's 2025. We're in Southeast England, not somewhere in Africa. And I open the tap and no water comes out. It's just horrendous. It's really, really bad.
Leanne, thank you very much. I hope the water does get turned on very, very soon indeed in your house, and also life resumes a bit more normality, especially with schools and your son's school reopening. South East Water has apologised, saying a recurring water quality issue which caused the initial water treatment shutdown has slowed their ability to get the system back online as quickly as they'd hoped. They say they're working closely with local councils and resilience forums in order to find the best solutions for those still without supply, and bottled water stations will reopen shortly at 9 o'clock this morning.
Time now 10:29. This time tomorrow morning, we will know how England are faring in their must-win second Ashes test against Australia. Defeat, and they're very much heading towards losing the five-match series. Victory, and of course, it's all game on. We've been hearing from friends of the Today programme ahead of the all-important test on what they think will save England's hopes in the Ashes.
Hello, my name is Felix White. I'm the co-host of the Tail Enders podcast with Sir Jimmy Anderson and Greg James, and I'm also in the Maccabees. My application, if you will, to help the England test team this week is, as we all know, the test lasted 2 days because of some, let's say, decision-making with the bat. The thing that I found myself really capable of in cricket and what drew me to it in the first place was blocking and leaving the ball. So I'm not sure I ever have actually played an aggressive shot or even attempted to. And it just feels like in that middle order, I hate to be the first person to say it, but they could do with someone like me. I can't tell you if I'm going to have the guts for the pink ball or even see it, but I guarantee you this, I will not be throwing my wicket away by having a go at one outside off stump. Have a think on it.
Hello, this is Dom Jolly, comedian, travel writer, an avid test cricket enthusiast. And my plan to get England to save their ashes is this. Bat longer, bowl faster, field better. Not taking any questions at this time, thank you.
Hello, I am Andy Zaltzman, Test Match Special Statistician. The way England can save the ashes is simply by looking at the statistics. This is the second test in Brisbane. History shows us that in 20 Ashes series in Australia since the Second World War, three of them have been drawn, and of the other 17, the team that's won the second test has won the series 16 times out of those 17. So we don't need to worry about the first test. That's now irrelevant. In fact, we don't even need to worry about the third, fourth and fifth tests. England just needs to win this one. Then they can lose the other four and still win the series. I think that's what the stats suggest. Also, looking at scoring rates, England scored at 4.9 and over in Perth, Australia at 4.5. History shows that whenever England have scored at least 0.1 run and over quicker than Australia, they have never lost an Ashes. 9 wins, 3 draws. So that's all they need to do. Just keep scoring more quickly than Australia. And scientifically, statistically, they cannot lose.
This is Piers Morgan. I'm completely baffled about why we're having a debate about how to save the Ashes. We've lost one match. Our captain is Benjamin Stokes. Do you think he's really going to lose another one? No. All right, I've downgraded my prediction from 5-0 to 4-1. But we are going to win the Ashes. You should change this debate to how will Australia save the Ashes after the drubbing coming their way in Brisbane. Thank you.
Piers Morgan there. For that, Andy Zaltzman, Dom Jolly, and Felix White. We will bring you all the Ashes actions. It kicks off at 4 a.m. tomorrow. Just as we're getting into work, we'll be across that, Justin.
Time 7 minutes to nine. The German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, heads to the UK today. It's a 3-day state visit, the first by a German president in 27 years. And all the stops are being pulled out. There's going to be a Windsor Castle state banquet, a speech to Parliament, which is a rare honour for a foreign visitor. Let us talk to John Jungklassen, who is a German journalist and historian based here in London, and Malika Faschero, who is on the line, who's a journalist in Germany, who covers particularly youth politics and social issues. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Malika, can I start with you? Do young people in Germany notice this kind of thing? Does it make any difference to anyone, and particularly the kind of people that you cover and are interested in?
Well, of course, young people are very excited that Frank-Walter Steinmeier is now in the UK. Especially, I would say that many of them were very heartbroken that work opportunities, education opportunities were dimmed by Brexit. So I would describe the situation here among the youth in Germany as very hopeful.
Yeah, there is a link, isn't there? It's interesting, among young people, you think particularly in both directions, actually, young British people, very enamoured, particularly of Berlin and the general culture scene there. And you're saying the opposite direction as well. German, younger Germans want to come here, are interested in this country.
Yeah, of course. So, for example, for our listeners in the UK, before there were scholarships programs here in Germany that would cover European tuition fees. And when the UK left Brexit, of course, the UK was not part of the European Union anymore. So many Germans were not they could not study in the UK unless they would pay overseas fees, which are horrendous. They're quite, you know, expensive. So from an education perspective, they're very hopeful that maybe they can pay the fees that the British students would pay. And also from a work perspective.
John Jungklassen, given that this is not a political figure, the president, and nor is the king a political figure. How much expectation is there that behind the scenes, actually, this does lead to political change and the kind of things that Malik has just been talking about?
Well, I think the political change is already underway. The Erasmus program that that we just talked about, that ended with Brexit, is being picked up again. They are discussing that they will find a replacement program for that. Question is, as always, who is going to fund it? But like Keir Starmer has done from the very beginning when he entered Downing Street, his move to come get closer to Europe again and pick up those few things that are clearly only in Britain's interest as well as Europe's interest, they can be reestablished outside the framework of
Give us examples of that outside. So we talked about Erasmus and young people's exchanges, etc. What else is on the cards, do you think, from this visit, if not necessarily to be announced today or in the next 3 days, then something that they're working on thinking about?
But they continued that they signed the Lancaster House Agreement, which meant that they're talking again regularly. During Brexit, even during the pandemic, it was extraordinary how people in Berlin and London, in both governments, had actually stopped communicating with each other completely. And if you remember, Merz came, German Chancellor, came to Britain in July, and even then, he couldn't help himself and make a comment about Brexit. People felt personally hurt by that decision. Almost 10 years on, people still can't believe it. It's a bit emotional, I think. But
And for young people, Malika, is that the same? That there is this kind of sense that we were all at one and now we're not, and there is a rift to be healed?
Yeah, of course. I would definitely say that between the older generation and the generation alike, I think the younger generation is even more heartbroken because, you know, young people here in Germany, they have a soft spot in London. Especially we have a lot of Brits, as you mentioned, in Berlin. Berlin's one of the few English speaking-ish, I would say, capitals here in Europe, where we welcome Brits, and just also to reflect a bit the sentiment in the whole country here in Germany. There were press papers here leading with the title, "Are we over the shock of the Brexit now?" So as my fellow journalist in the UK has mentioned, the UK leaving the European Union was taken very, very personally here in Germany.
I suppose that the thing that's happened, though, since then, Malika, that may well lead to a rethink on both sides, and in a sense is leading to it, is the full invasion of Ukraine and the various pressures on us all, financial and more than financial, that there are. Has that had an impact, do you think, on German thinking?
Yeah, I do believe that, especially through the government change in the last few years, there is a sense of thinking more is more, meaning more opportunities for everyone is more opportunities for everyone. So if we give more opportunities to our youth in Germany, in the UK, and vice versa, we will all benefit from it. So this is definitely one thing.
John, has Ukraine, in your view, brought us together?
Oh, absolutely. I think the coalition of the willing. So I think the combination of Trump being in the White House and Washington.